We have a lot of testimony to get in. And so we're going to get started. I want to thank the members that are here. And we'll start off by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3588. Thank you. And all you get is House Bill 3588. Okay, we'll just start out then with the first panel of folks who are here. Is Representative Lehman in the room? Okay, we'll just go on with Linda Ludwig and anybody else that you want to invite up.
Representative Strobeck and members of the committee. I believe Representative Lehman will be in shortly, and he was going to give you an overview of the bill. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning and talk to you about House Bill 3588. We want you to come away with believing that you should pursue this bill for the funding of after-school and school break programs for our youth. Because of your long agenda, we have pared down our testimony to a minimum. Although it goes without saying, our mayors and commissioners could speak to this issue at much length. I have prepared some written information for you in this notebook, which I would ask you to review in detail at a later time. Mayor Tory from Eugene will give you some background information, which is available in more detail in Section 1. Mayor Drake from Beaverton will review Section 2 with you today, data which provides linkages between youth programs and cigarette use. Section 3 is a spreadsheet that illustrates the distribution method of the revenues in the bill, and Section 4 contains letters of strong support from across the state for House Bill 3588. I would like to introduce Mayor Tory from Eugene at this time.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Chair Strobeck and members of the committee, first I want to thank you for allowing us the opportunity to present this proposal to you today. For the past 2 years, the League of Oregon Cities have worked very diligently in an attempt to bring together representatives of the counties, the school districts, and the cities to try to find a way to deal with young people that we have come to be known as at-risk children. And at this point, I'd like to point out that in our opinion, all children are potentially at risk, not just those that might be perpetrators of activities. Everyone that I speak to in this legislative body indicates a need for this type of program. The governor's office, the county commissioners, the city councils, all of us, including representatives of the House and Senate. The issue is, how do we pay for it? I'm going to tell you that there are no easy answers, and I'm sure I don't have to tell you that. We, on a much smaller scale, end up having to answer questions just as you do on a weekly basis with people who come to our councils and ask for funds for programs, and we simply say that the dollars just won't stretch far enough. The problem that I face, though, as the mayor of a city with a large number of young people who leave school with no place to go until their parents or parent comes home following work and we ask why we're having a tremendous increase in juvenile crime in our city, and we end up having to answer the question because, frankly, we are not able to provide sufficient amounts of services for these young people. Frequently, we ask our young people to say no to drugs, to say no to promiscuous sex, to say no to alcohol, and frankly, I would hope that we could find a way to come together and find a way to say yes to providing them with services, to providing them with a service to fill the gap that follows the school day and fills in that time period before the parent comes home. I would also point out that there are opportunities here to leverage the dollars that we're asking to be generated here. Many businesses in my community, and I would bet that the same thing exists throughout the state of Oregon, will tell you that they're prepared to do something to assist young people, but they need the vehicle, they need the program, they need to identify where those dollars could be put that would in fact provide a meaningful service. I think that this set of dollars on an ongoing basis would provide that vehicle. I don't doubt that any of us believe that this is needed. I urge us, however, to find a way to take care of those young people who do not have the ideal situation, which would be that there is a loving home with one of the parents available to them, or a grandparent, or an aunt, or an uncle, for them to come home to. And all of us agree that there are some parents who can afford to provide financially for those services that they could send their children to, even though both parents may work. But the children that I'm concerned about are those children who do not have that ability. And frankly, I don't think we can afford not to help them. I would hope that you would look at this as I've tried to look at it. If this were your child, or in my case, if these were my grandsons, and the need was there, I would find a way to take care of that need. Unfortunately, the children that need this service most don't have someone like yourself and myself to provide those individual services. I'd be happy to answer questions, but at this time, Representative Lehman is here, and I would think he would probably be the best person to answer some of the basic questions on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Representative Mike Lehman from District 47, which is on the Southern Oregon Coast. House Bill 3588 does a few things. First of all, it raises about $15 million to distribute to cities by enacting an additional 6 cents per pack cigarette tax. The revenues we designated to cities on a per youth population basis would establish a youth advisory committee in each community to determine how those monies are to be spent, and the revenues are dedicated to new or existing youth programs and cannot be used as backfill dollars, which we discovered in other areas can pose problems when you put new revenue in. This came about in working with Mayor Tory and members of the League of Cities in the interim, dealing probably more than anything else in response to the thirsting crisis. It also is an issue very important to me based in my community. We have raised some words up $3 million to construct a new Boys and Girls Club down there. And we have about a 70,000 square foot building that is shelled in, and we are now putting the finishing touches on the inside. Before that, it operated, the youth program started when the school districts cut all activities from the elementary level. And I know that because I was on the school board when we did it to save money for the school district. This group formed to provide, at first, athletic activities and has expanded into Saturday Academy and other educational programs for young people. We then became affiliated with the Boys and Girls Club. We are on the eve of having this building open and operating, and it is politically so sound because it sits right on the boundaries of Coos Bay and North Bend. If you know small communities, that's essential. It's going to serve the entire youth of that community. The problem we face is we may finish the building, open it up, and not have enough money to staff the building on a regular basis. And my biggest fear is we have this beautiful facility open only for 4 hours a day because we can't staff it or pay the cost the rest of the time. We don't have a park and rec district. The cities and counties don't have additional funds or are not able to put funds into this program. This is a means for them to fill that gap. It provides the third leg of the stool. You have the school districts involved, We have all the programs through the various organizations dealing with youth at risk. This is the third leg. It provides activities for kids to keep them out of trouble. I think this is an essential way to establish foundation-level funding to get programs for kids opened up in the communities, and then the communities can go out and raise additional revenue through auctions and other things to provide the extra activities. I think this is a great step in providing something for our kids to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. And Mr. Mayor, any questions at this point? Representative Webb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, do you see any kind of a logical nexus between any additional tax on cigarettes and this program that this would fund?
Two nexus. Chair Strobeck, Representative Webb, two nexus. One is it's politically the easiest tax to add on, which is something that we all think about. But secondly, yes, I believe Ms. Ludwig has some data that shows a very strong connection between smoking cigarettes, alcohol use, substance abuse, and juvenile crime. And I think she's going to go into that a little bit later.
But, Representative, I think that's tab two.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to call at this time Mayor Rob Drake and Joel Showalter.
Morning, Mr. Mayor.
Good morning. Lower this for Jill and me. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Rob Drake, and I'm the mayor of Beaverton. I have with me this morning Jill Showalter, who's project director for Oregon Partnership. I'll talk briefly, and then Jill will make a presentation, and if we could, I'd like to go over Section 2 briefly with you. I'm here this morning to support House Bill 3588. I did serve on the League of Oregon Cities task force last year that was headed by Mayor Tory, whom you just heard from, and Bill Morissette, who's a member of your body this year. And that task force was set up initially in response to the Springfield shooting. While the Littleton, Colorado shooting is tragic, my interest in this and the league's interest began long before that shooting. Cities want to provide local dollars for after-school programs, but we don't have enough money due to tax reduction measures and tax compression. Beaverton, though, is doing some things, and much like North Bend and Coos Bay, I'd like to talk a little bit about our program. Beaverton has a PAL program that's been in effect in the city effectively for the last couple of years. PAL means Police Activities League. Jill happens to be our part-time director of our PAL program, and a third of our police officers, or well over 30 of our police officers, are actively involved in the PAL program. Last year, PAL made over 700 contacts with youth in our community. But this is only a part-time program. We also have a peer court program in Beaverton that's been a model for many peer courts throughout the state. And the largest offense that is dealt with in peer court is youth smoking. The costs of not providing a program such as this are far greater than not providing the cost because incarceration is the end result. Incarceration far exceeds the cost of a program like this. We do now have a vehicle such as this, a small cigarette tax increase, to provide adequate resources to address the problem in a comprehensive manner, and there is a strong nexus to that funding source. I'll go ahead and turn it over to Jill and then address the graph in your booklet.
Okay.
Honorable Chairperson and members of the committee, thank you for giving us the opportunity to present this very important issue today. I'm here today representing two organizations that I work for. I am the part-time director, executive director for the Beaverton Police Activities League, a recreational and educational program for kids that uses off-duty police officers, as Mayor Drake alluded to, as well as I'm the project director for Oregon Partnership, a nonprofit organization that provides resources and referrals for drug and alcohol abuse. I have over 11 years in the field of prevention with kids. In 1997, in Beaverton, a survey was conducted in three of the seven middle schools. The findings have resulted in important policy changes for the school district. The survey contained items that addressed key outcome indicators, including the use of tobacco by Beaverton Middle School students. The outcome indicators provide insight to the various risk behaviors commonly done and experienced by students. It was found that 38% of 8th grade students and 55% of 10th grade students had used tobacco at one time in their life. Of those 10th grade students who reported smoking sometime in their life, more than 42% of them started smoking before the ages of 13. Additionally, it was found that some of the major factors associated with these outcomes included the correlation of participating in extracurricular activities. 8th and 10th grade students who were involved in two or more activities were less likely to become involved in these risky behaviors. Additionally, it was found that students who reported spending their time after school, quote, hanging out with friends, were more likely to become involved in these risky behaviors. This was particularly so with tobacco and marijuana use, and with those students who reported that they felt it was wrong, there was a higher use, or not use. The statistics show students in Beaverton do smoke. Why do the kids smoke? As the survey indicated, it is because they have idle time on their hands. They have no perceived risk that it is wrong. They are in an environment where it is acceptable. They are doing it because those around them, their peers, are smoking. And lastly, they are engaging in smoking because they are not engaged in a constructive activity that prevents their use. The middle school students of Beaverton are finding the place, the time, and the environment in which they can engage in this illegal and unhealthy practice. If we can engage these kids in meaningful ways to occupy their time, place them in environments where it is not socially acceptable, and reinforce to them the health, legal, and social risks, we will be preventing many of these kids from adopting these behaviors that put them at risk for tobacco addiction and other negative behaviors. I ask you this, why was Joe Camel laid to rest? Because he was contributing to the factor to tobacco use by our kids. Clearly we all know he was not the only cause, but Joe Camel definitely was a contributing factor. We are today asking that the tobacco industry take some responsibility and ask that they also help to prevent some of Beaverton's young people from becoming addicted. The community has already stepped up to the plate by providing community-based programs for our youth, but they need more. They need more support and they need more dollars. The tobacco industry can provide that support. This is a win-win situation for Beaverton's youth. With your support, we can provide more quality after-school programs for Beaverton's youth and also help a healthy future for our kids. I close with the story of a young lady I met 5 years ago. While running an after-school program at Five Oaks Middle School in Beaverton, Melissa was a seventh grader, 12 years old. She smoked and she hung out with a group of friends that was acceptable for her. Her mom called me wanting to engage her daughter in something after school because all she currently was doing was hanging out. Melissa got involved with our after-school program, which led her into taking a peer leadership role in our summer day camp program that took place. Unfortunately, when the fall came around, there was no more funding to service the 694 students that had become involved in my after-school and summer program. When fall rolled around, Melissa also fell by the wayside. She went back to hanging out with her friends, who now also, consequently, was a peer group who found it acceptable to smoke marijuana and to drink alcohol. Melissa got involved more with her friends, less with activities, more with alcohol, and ended up running away. Melissa, a year later, was part of the transient kids living downtown. Her mom tracked me down, looking for help. I could only give her moral support and referral and resources to other programs. The ironic part of this story is that at the time, her daughter was not only needing after-school activities and programs, but at this time, she was hanging out with the wrong peer group. The irony in it, she was also needing a program to fulfill her community service hours that were mandated to her from the juvenile department.
Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mayor or Jill?
Mr. Chairman, if we could review Section 2 real briefly, and I may ask for some of Linda's help on this. But we have the results of some surveys here that I think definitely link cigarette smoking and potential for it, that being a gateway drug to other more negative usage. You can see from these that, for example, the one that says 1998 Oregon Student Survey relationship between smoking and participation in youth programs, you can see that those involved in youth programs do not get involved with cigarette use. Looking further, those that have been suspended have a high cigarette use. Those who have missed school, and the same thing with the point average, they have a high usage of tobacco. Moving on, the relationship between smoking and juvenile crime, those who've sold drugs have a high cigarette usage, something stolen, those who've been arrested, and those stopped by police, a very strong usage pattern again. And the relationship between smoking and violence, carried a handgun, very strong percentage, fighting with the weapon, attacking someone, and lastly, gang involvement. And on the final chart, relationship between smoking and alcohol and drug abuse or drug use, drunken at school, very high percentage of cigarette use, driving under the influence, and also those ridden with a user, very high usage. We think there's a strong case to be made, the linkage between smoking and negative behavior on part of youth. What we're asking the legislature and this panel to consider is helping us fund programs to provide activities for youth in the afternoon, positive activities. Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mayor Drake, maybe you can help me understand the relevance of these charts. To me, this is shown as a correlation between smoking and stealing or being arrested. It doesn't indicate to me there's any causal relationship. So, I mean, what's the relevance of these charts relative to this bill?
The relevance, Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, the relevance is simply that youth that do not have, are not using their time well, are smoking, and they don't have role models that would be anti-smoking role models, and children that are left really unhandled, uncared for in the afternoons are not getting the kind of, unfortunately, the kind of leadership that they should, and that they are smoking and they're doing other negative behavior. And the relationship is that they are using cigarettes, and I think there's a strong linkage with cigarette being a potential gateway drug to other negative behavior, uses of marijuana, other drug use, and alcohol.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For coming down today.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Francisconi from Portland, Vicki Thompson from the City of Gresham, and I'm Kathy Turner from the City of Portland as well.
Thanks, members of the committee, especially thanks to you, Representative Strobeck, for allowing this hearing. I'd like to also thank the Mayor of Springfield, then Bill Norris-Fett, and Mayor Tory for recognizing there was a profound tragedy in their community, and they tried to use that to benefit children in my city and children across the state, and I appreciate that very much. I'd also like to thank the League of Oregon Cities, who recognized something that it took me a while to recognize, that we have programs for early childhood at-risk programs and other types of programs. We have a lot of programs for high-risk kids, gang-involved kids, some of which I've actively lobbied for. But our cities have no programs for the kids or the working folks to pay the bills and pay the taxes. And they recognize that gap that most cities, unlike Portland where we have a little bit of resources for after school, most cities don't. And it's those kids that can rise up to cause havoc in the community, as we've profoundly demonstrated. There was a cartoon in today's paper, The Oregonian, that shows a sewer pipe with some kids playing in it with guns and a hatchet. That sewer pipe says American culture. And up above it, there's a older man watching TV with the words saying, "Sure, I let the kids play in it. What's wrong with that?" Then in yesterday's paper, there's an article talking about the 200 most popular video rentals by our young people, and all of them had the appearance of alcohol, tobacco, or illegal drugs. So we have the suicide, we have the materialism of our culture that teaches our young people that they don't have any responsibilities other than themselves. So what we're asking for here is lifelines for opportunities for kids to have more extended time for schoolwork, an extended school day, which these after-school programs can do for educational purposes, and we're asking for opportunities for relationships with significant adults that can happen. This is what our kids need, and our kids need an opportunity to contribute back to the community, and that's what these after-school programs can provide. The cities have no way to say to their children, there's a place for you in our city. These after-school programs allow cities to say that. Cities have no way of saying to replace guns with diplomas and paychecks. After-school programs, partnered with the schools and community groups in the private sector, allow the opportunity to do that. Now, we've been fortunate in Portland, I'm also the Parks Commissioner, that we have some after-school programs and some community school programs. But because of the private sector stepping up and Bank of America contributing $100,000, we were able to extend the school day at Lane Middle School. We have the principal here, we have some kids here, and we have some teachers here. You may not have time to hear from all, that can demonstrate to you the power of what a program coordinated with the schools can do. This legislature has spent, and the state has spent a lot of time concentrating on how to fund education for 6 hours earlier in the day. We spent a lot of time discussing charter schools and the flexibility that that can bring in under certain circumstances. But these after-school hours allow volunteers, they allow nonprofits, they allow business folks to come into these schools to provide the same kind of services and to help meet academic standards, if they're designed right, as well as reduce juvenile crime. So the results that we've had in this experience in Portland are such that we've been able, in one middle school now, just one, we've been able to expand arts, sports, computer, and homework help assistance, especially in math and science. The participation in academic arts and science program has tripled from 40 to 250 students voluntarily coming into one of the poorer communities in Brentwood, Darlington. The suspensions have declined from 50 to 15 in the first semester. Parental involvement has gone. They couldn't find anybody to be on these parental site councils. Now there's more than 50 that have volunteered to be on the site councils. Nationally, the research is there to show that these things work. So this bill, and most importantly, it gives a chance for kids to contribute back with volunteer service. So they're cleaning up stream beds along Johnson Creek as part of this after-school program. So I guess we're asking for allowing cities to play in this effort to give alternatives to our young people. If additional funding could allow us to expand this to other poor and middle-class communities in Portland. More significantly, I think it would give other cities the opportunity to play so that we can provide these lifelines instead of just the sewers in which many of our kids fall. I'd be happy, I'd be eager to answer questions.
Okay, well, we'll go ahead with the testimony.
Morning. Former legislative assistant here, now a city councilor for Gresham. What I wanted to share with you, and you've all received this, because it's been faxed, it's been mailed, everything was agreed to get the hearing, and I really appreciate you for holding this hearing this morning and giving us an opportunity to speak. On April 17th...
Excuse me. Former L.A., you need to identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. Gresham City Councilor Vicki Thompson.
Thank you,
Representative.
Yeah. Go ahead.
In Gresham, I'm just Vicki.
Oh, Okay.
I don't like to wear the title. I'd rather just see it work. Anyway, on April 17th, the city of Gresham held its first youth summit. There were 21 students that attended. After extended discussions, the consensus was that Gresham, Fairview, Wood Village, Troutdale, and Gresham need a youth center. All of the students that attended the summit are willing to make this a reality in our community. They're willing to step up to the plate and help this to happen. Funding is the major component in making the center a reality. House Bill 3588 would increase the tax on cigarettes. 10.34% would be credited to the youth activities account in the general fund that is also created with this legislation. Monies in the youth activities account are appropriated continuously to the cities of this state in accordance with the distribution schedule set forth in the bill. I am submitting copies from an article that was published in the Oregonian, a copy of an editorial from the Oregonian, a copy of an article from the Parks and Recreation newsletter, and an article from the Gresham Outlook. As one of the youth was quoted in the Oregonian article, Gresham is designed for older population. It's not a town designed to entertain us or keep us here. I do not think that Gresham is the only community in our state that lacks a place for youth to call their own. The article from the Parks and Rec talks about youth centers in Redmond, Washington, and Portland, Oregon. I submitted this to you so you would have an idea of what other communities have accomplished. Our kids deserve a place of their own. The school shootings in Denver demonstrate the need of our youth more than we can possibly say in words. Please pass House Bill 3588 with a due pass recommendation to the House for a vote. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you both. Any questions? Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I assume that you both have given some thought as to how you would fund these programs should this bill pass if cigarette consumption continue to decline and lower revenues come into this program over time, while costs and needs may even escalate. Have you given some thought to that?
Absolutely. And that was one of the reasons for making this a youth center for all four of our cities in the East County. We want to set this up as a separate nonprofit so that the city can take the funds and give it to the youth center for operation. We will do continuing ongoing fundraising events, also applying for grant funds, whatever opportunities we can to keep this going. It will be a community event. It will be a community center.
I'd like to try to answer that. Whenever we're trying to spend tax dollars, we try to get more than one benefit. Here, this kind of bill could have the benefit of two things. One, a source of revenue, but the other is driving down teen smoking and other smoking. That's the point of it. And so there's a double benefit. But specifically to answer your question, in city general funds have to be a source of this and are currently. The county, we have this partnership with the county where the county's putting in money. The federal government has grants available that we're actively seeking. In addition to the Bank of America, we're doing the same thing with a nonprofit for the private sector to contribute. I forgot to mention the coalition of ministers that are working as part of this, so we have the church community contributing. And so it's a comprehensive approach. We just don't have the state as a partner in this. We have the other players, but the state's not a partner. One last point I would like forgot to make on the issue of kind of nexus. It also, in addition to things Mayor Drake said, it's kind of how we define health for the community, too. Providence Hospital, for example, defines health in broader terms to include the general health of the community. So they gave a loan executive for 2 years to help create after-school programs and to help create employment programs. We're asking the cigarette industry that benefits directly, more directly than Providence, to make a small contribution.
Representative Merkley.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Commissioner Francisconi, I was impressed by the decline in suspensions from 50 to 15. Was that at Innsmead and the other pilot?
It was at Lane.
Was it Lane? How does one go about targeting these programs to the kids who are traditionally uninvolved, these kids who are smoking, selling drugs, using alcohol, and so forth? It's quite possible to have programs that kids who are already quite active would take advantage of, but what has Portland been able to do to target the kids who tend not to get involved?
Mike Harris, who's the principal of Lane, is here, who could better answer the question. He's also the director now of our efforts on community schools. But it's back to the teachers and the counselors who target the kids and then refer them to these after-school programs. and then we target the parents of these particular kids with outreach to the homes of the parents and the kids. Then the key, though, is eventually, and it took time to do this, peer pressure, peer directed to direct. So there's enough activities that kids want to be there, and they reach out to themselves. So that may be too general, but it's the counselor and the teachers who work directly with the providers who are nonprofits in the after-school program, and they do family visits directly to those kids.
Another question, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Do you have a sense in your respective cities of what percentage increase in activities will result as a consequence of these funds that come through this tax?
Well, see, because of the generosity of base, these programs have to get to scale. We have a lot of isolated programs that are not to scale. So you had 40 kids participating until Bank of America's 100,000 private contribution. Then it went to 250 because you're able to get the programs to scale and coordinate it. So that's the problem. You have a lot of nonprofits competing for the same dollars, but nobody to organize it and bring it to scale. So the answer is 40 to 250 in Lane Community Schools.
In the process of putting the Youth Summit together, I visited with over 300 middle school and high school students. And the majority of them, as I visited with them, the main thing that they kept saying, all of them, even before the Youth Summit, was, we need a place of our own. So I can envision, I don't have statistics for you, I can't do that, but I know there's the need, the kids in print, I mean, there's no place for them to go. They're just aching for a place that they can call their own. So I feel real confident that we can make this work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't think anybody doubts the need to have programs for kids after school, but don't you think there's kind of a mixed message being sent that if you say, hey, kids, if you smoke one more pack, we'll get that basketball court? And isn't there kind of a mixed message there?
I would love to see the price of cigarettes so expensive kids couldn't afford it. It breaks my heart when I drive around our community and I see kids standing on the street corner smoking, because I know what the end is. I've watched people die of emphysema, and it's long, drawn out, and awful.
Now we're sending our kids two messages. If you get into gangs, we got something for you. If you don't, we don't. The other message we're sending is, kids, great. We have nothing for you for after school. We have prisons for you if you cross the line. But we have nothing for you after school. And we bombard those same kids with all these messages in order to get them to do things. But then we get them to yell at them for doing.
Any other questions? Single?
I think what you're proposing here is fine, but the mechanism by which we fund it, I think, is in question. Why wouldn't we take this on at the community level or at the state level and just straight up general fund take care of it?
Well, first of all, in Portland we are doing that, but we can't ramp it up. But my heart breaks for Gresham and Springfield and all these other places that don't have the resources to do it. This is a problem that has to be addressed at multiple levels, and the state needs to be a player, a small player. $15 million statewide is a small player.
We just finished the budget process in Gresham. This is my first time around as an elected official through that process. And it was all I kept telling the councilors was, we're really going to have to do some soul searching to set our priorities. We ended up being able to fund fire and police, not for what we need, but what we could get by with for this year. Parks didn't get what they need. Our rec programs are not the greatest. And I don't even want the greatest. I just like to have adequate. We don't even have that. So trying to fund it out of our own funds isn't fair. And I realize your funds are tight also. At this point, anything will help us. We're just getting this off the ground, and that's the way we're looking at it. It's just a start.
Sure.
Seems to be more of a top-down approach. Wouldn't it be better to go back to our local communities and ask if the parents want to contribute, be part of this, and take on the funding mechanism there?
Well, Representative Welsh, since April 17th when we had the Youth Summit, my phone is ringing. People are speaking to me. There's one person in particular that's a mover and shaker in our community that probably hasn't spoken to me in years. She is now. I got an organization, The Optimist, asked me the other day, when can we go into the fundraising mode? So I'm looking at this tax as part of the package, but not the whole funding mechanism. I'm really anxious to get the nonprofit part set up because there's people rising to the occasion. It's going to be fun to make it happen.
Representative, I agree with your fundamental point that I do think parents should be asked to contribute to these programs, and I think that should be an element. Now, the problem, though, is in some of these poor communities, like Maine, let me tell you a story. One of the parents said, look, in this program now, there's parents participating with their kids in some of these activities, but this is one of the first times I can do something with my kids because I can't afford to go to the movies now. I can't afford to do things because it costs so much. Kids want to do these things that cost money. Parents can't afford it. So we can't provide the kind of family entertainment that the kids expect without some help in the poorer communities.
Mr.
Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
One of the traditional youth involvement, some of the youth, traditional youth involvement organizations are the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts. And can you speak or do you have any experience with the ability, they're volunteer-led, adult-led. Are you seeing an increase, a drop-off in adults' ability to continue to build these programs?
My son is a star rank scout, Boy Scout, which I'm very proud to say. And what I'm seeing in the different troops, when you get to middle school, do you see a drop-off? Our troop has managed to maintain anywhere from 35 to 50 boys. We see a large influx coming in every year from the grade school, but then by the time they get to seventh grade, they're kind of, ooh, there's something else I'd rather be doing, or it's not cool. Our skateboarders in our community don't think Scouts is cool. So it's hard to maintain those kids in the Boy Scouts. It's not anything like when we talk about after-school activities. And what I found, it's not sports. I mean, my kid's not a sports kid. There's a lot of kids in our community that aren't into sports. They need something else. They need another place to offer them other things to do. And that's what we're trying to do here.
I guess one point, what we're trying to do is get those groups involved to do it. So Parks, for example, in Portland, is going to be a broker of services. We're not adding city employees. The purpose of this funding is to contract with these groups to give them more capacity and then organize them to spin off the school. So there's a lot of great groups. Middle school and Campfire may not quite fit, but there's some other organizations out there that do.
Mr. Chair, if I might follow up.
Okay.
My personal experience from both of my daughters' experience, and my younger daughter is in grade school, we can't get a Girl Scout troop together. We don't have any parents willing or able to give the time to put it together.
Our troop are really lucky. We have a lot of parents, including my husband and myself, that are willing to step, rise to the occasion. We'll take as many kids as we need to take to make sure that these things happen. If the boys have the interest to go, we'll take them. Absolutely, and we're real fortunate that way.
Who's next? Say what?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this a new problem? Was this problem around 30 or 40 years ago? Is this issue of being able to provide after-school care for students? And if it wasn't a problem 30 or 40 years ago, why do we have the problem today, in your opinion?
Well, 30 to 40 years ago was when, not quite before I was growing up. Oh, maybe it is. Anyway, I've got to remember how old I am here. Our fathers worked, our mothers stayed at home, so we didn't have the child care. My mother didn't want to stay at home with us, and we had child care available to us. But kids went home to their families or to parents, so we didn't have that then.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up.
Sure.
What do you think has happened that has forced so many families for both parents to be out working, whereas 30 or 40 years ago they didn't have to?
Well, aggression. It's the cost of housing. I mean, it's astronomical. I bought my house in 79, and I'm not afraid to say I paid $72,000 for it. Well, I don't even want to tell you what it's worth now. It's embarrassing. I keep asking my friend an appraiser, is it really worth this much? Housing is really expensive. Groceries. I mean, I can remember, let's go back to high school, 25 cents for a gallon of gas. It's too expensive, and so parents end up working.
I think economics are part of it, but I think the sewer pipe is bigger in terms of what American culture has done in terms of causing a breakdown in the family. The fact that 75-80% of Humboldt school kids come from single-parent kids' households, and many of those are not either mother or father,
a grandparent. I think there has been a breakdown. So the key is, how do you, in addition to some economic issues that I totally agree with, how do you provide role models in addition to the parents, and then how do you support the families? And that's what these after-school efforts are designed to do. And I also think our society is much more violent. And we can get into issues, but the prevalence of weapons, which I hesitate to go there, but there's availability of drugs, weapons, etc., that there wasn't 30 to 40 years ago, cigarettes, etc. But the combination of the breakdown and the pervasive effect of some of the downsides of the way we make money in this society.
Let me remind members that we've got lots of bills to go, and there's still a lot more people to speak on this one, and this is the first one. Unless it's a real burning question, please hold it. Very well.
Thank you.
We do have one burning question.
I only think that we have
fun intended.
We've got infrastructure in place, and we have also supervision in place, but by changing, couldn't we just change some scheduling, especially at our schools, that would cover this 3 o'clock to 6 or 7 o'clock period of time without costing a lot of money? We just change some scheduling here and take on a lot of this without extra cost. Something that has been talked about before, I know I certainly have, and it's been a part of something that I've thought about. Well, we've never been able to get past that because of the opposition that we have many times in a splitting schedule. And that means our teachers being part of this. Certainly for those individuals that are involved in the sporting, in sports after school, that is covered, for those, especially for those parents. But I think we could do a lot here without increased need for funding.
Well, I mean, I don't think you can do that. I don't think you can pass a law to just extend this without doing this. Plus, one of the good benefits, if there is a good benefit of the school crisis, it has to be that we all have a responsibility to raise our children. The community has a responsibility. The days where the schools could solely address this and teachers could be counselors, coaches, etc., role models, I don't think you can do it, especially given the class sizes. So I think we all have to contribute to this thing, and you can't just do it that way, is my respectful disagreement.
Well, I think it's the parents' responsibility. It's not more than the community's to raise the children to begin with, but I also believe that as a public buildings and public facilities out there, that we can use them for multiple reasons.
Representative Ross, in Gresham, our school district does utilize our buildings. We're very fortunate. We have a company that was created as a nonprofit, and they do provide child care for a certain number of kids. That's all they can take in, but parents still have to pay for it. There is a charge for it. Our schools, we have, they're always being used. I mean, it's hard to get in to even have a meeting because they're so heavily booked up. So I can honestly say I know that our school buildings aren't just sitting there empty. We're using them.
At one point, though, agreeing with you on this, principals and teachers in the past have had a majority, I might even go so far as to say, have had the attitude that it's their building. And if it's going to mean messing up the classroom or having people come in from the outside, they're not going to tolerate it. Those days are over, too. And I think you'll hear the teachers from Lane School, et cetera, saying, it's worth my classroom being messed up for the opportunity to provide additional services. So I think in that regard, your point is well taken.
Okay, thank you both very much.
Mr. Chair, I know we're trying to move ahead. In terms of time, let me quickly call Randy Westrick, Lloyd Toll, and Mike Harris.
Go ahead, who's first?
Good morning, Representative Strobeck and the committee. I'm pleased to be here. My name is Randy Westrick. I'm the Recreation and Parks Director for the City of Woodburn. And I can provide a little contrast. You just heard the biggest city, the biggest metropolitan area in the state. We're not the smallest, and we're growing, and that's part of the problem. The City of Woodburn provides after-school activities for as many kids as we can. We now have an activity center, a drop-in center after school that is supported by the community. There was talk about community involvement. We have a model of community involvement that works, but it needs to be expanded. We're not serving all the kids that we can. There was also a question about what happens when cigarette tax decreases, and I would hope that it would. And I can tell you that dealing with varying uncertain funding sources and keeping programs going is the stock and trade in parks and recreation. We will keep up if that was to happen, and we'll find a way to fund it. Right now, our program is funded through a partnership with the city, the school district, local businesses, parents, nonprofit corporations, and almost any way we can get it. So we're out there digging, and when cigarette tax drops, we will find the money to do it. The other point I'd like to make is that kids won't fund it. Kids aren't supposed to be buying cigarettes, so kids shouldn't be funding this. Our city provides this drop-in center not because it's just a nice thing to do for kids. This program is provided because it builds our community. It gives families choices. Families who are choosing not to have their kids come home to an empty house, families that can't afford child care, and families who can't afford to have both parents in the house if there are two parents in the house. One of the problems is a lot of kids are coming from homes with only one parent. The other thing I'd like to raise to you is these programs aren't provided necessarily for kids on drugs, for kids who have abused alcohol, for kids who are involved in violence, for kids who are involved in crime, gangs, for brown kids, for black kids, or for white kids. These programs are provided for any kids as an alternative for them to all of the bad things that could happen to them. Finally, the point I'd like to make is when kids make bad choices, and every kid that's in trouble makes bad choices to get there, no matter what society's done to them, the kid made the choice. And those choices are usually made when they're not with their parents or parent and when they're not in school. They're made after school, during breaks, times when they don't have guidance from adults and good programs. This program, the program that we provide, is helping to guide these kids. And it's preventing crime. It's helping kids with their homework. And if nothing else, it's just giving them something to do after school. Our police chief reports that since this program opened, we've seen an 11 to 13% drop in vandalism and in crime in the area where we operated. We operated in one neighborhood within our city. The last point I'd like to make is investment in this program pays back. It pays back, and it pays back well. We had talked a little bit about kids ultimately winding up in the system, winding up being incarcerated. I've heard figures about that it costs about $30,000 a year to keep one kid incarcerated. We can operate a drop-in program at a school or in one of our facilities for about $25,000 a year. So if that prevents one kid from making a bad choice that is going to lead to him being incarcerated, it's paid for itself back. It's just one kid. The other thing is, the state pays the entire cost for that incarceration, the dollar cost. The community's not really involved. When the kid's in an after-school program or a parks and recreation program, the entire community is helping. So, again, we're asking the state to step to the plate and become a partner. the programs are preventative. They pay themselves back. My father was an engineer. He operated the dams up on the Willamette tributaries. And in the wintertime when there would be flooding situation, he'd come home and he'd say, we just paid for ourselves. We just prevented the state capital from being flooded. And we had enough savings to pay for the construction of this dam. I would say that the same thing happens when we invest in these kids in these after-school programs, that they will pay back. And health care is a huge expense, not just in our community, not just to the state, but for all society. And if kids aren't making choices to smoke cigarettes, we'll be paid back in the end. And I think that a lot of those dollars will be made available for programs like ours. Finally, where I see the benefits of this program is we're operating our dropping center in one neighborhood, and one of the great successes is that we're in the neighborhood where parents can get to know us and trust us. We need to expand into the other neighborhoods that are served by our neighborhood schools. This will allow that expansion. We could triple the number of kids in our after-school program. We do very little for high school kids, and this will allow us to move into after-school programs for high school kids. Some of the benefits to that I've seen is a lot of times the kids that get involved in our programs aren't the captain of the football team and they're not the president of the student body. They're the other kids, and they can be referred to us by schools, and so we can get kids who are marginal involved in leadership who can do something positive, not just for kids, but also in the community. Thank you, and I want to thank Linda and the League for making this issue so important, and for folks like Mayor Tory who have brought it to you. And if you have any questions, I'm here, and I know these fellows have some comments, too.
Okay, just let me say, Linda, we're going to close this at 9:15. That's half of our scheduled time for all the agenda for this one bill, okay?
Mr. Chairman, committee, I'll be very brief. I'm Lloyd Toll. I'm the executive director of the Boys and Girls Club here in the Salem Kaiser community. I'm one of those staff members who are on a daily basis on the firing line trying to find the dollars, find the programs, meet the needs of our community. And let me tell you real briefly, while we could use the funds to be made available, if you could find a way to get the funds, I can tell you how I can leverage it. Right now, our organization provides three neighborhood youth centers, two outreach sites of gang prevention and community-wide sports. We're serving 9,000 kids in this community alone, and serving nearly 1,100 kids a day. And I can know right now, with the partnership I have with the Salem Kaiser School District, I can leverage your money into more private money. We have a partnership with the school district right now that allows us to use school property at no cost. We come in and build a facility, a modular facility of about 3,300 square feet, and I can serve 100 kids, 100 to 125 kids a day for $75,000 a year. Now, as my friend here next to me said, neighborhoods is where the answers are. We deal with youth problems. One youth center in one community will not meet the needs of the youth nor the community. You've got to reach in the neighborhoods. You've got to reach it where the kids are. You've got to get it where the kids can walk to it, skateboard to it, bicycle to it, however they get to it. But one center does not fit all kids. This money could take money locally and take it right into those neighborhoods. I think what it can provide is provide young people with that sense of self-identity we've talked about today, that broad base of competency, civic responsibility, physical well-being. But I think most important, these programs provide a moral compass, and I think that's the part we've been missing this morning, is that programs like this, targeting at-risk kids, or kids before they get in trouble, deals with that moral compass. I was very fortunate several months ago to attend a ceremony where General Colin Powell spoke about dedicating a new youth center in Las Vegas. It was the 2000s Boys and Girls Club Youth Center open. And I'm going to pull one of his quotes out of there. Quote, we do not have anything more important to do than to protect our youngsters and put them to the road of success. The choice is simple. Either we build our children or we build our jails. It's time to stop building jails and get back to what America knows how to do best, build our children, end of quote. You know, it's time to stop focusing on systems. It's time to be proactive with prevention-based after-school and summer programs, and it's find a way to leverage the available dollars out there with the private sector. The Boys and Girls Club does support this concept of finding the dollars. I think it's important that we place them into partnerships with private funding so we can maximize and give every youngster in grades 1 through 12 the opportunity to have a safe place to go after school.
Thank you.
Chair Strobeck and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mike Harris. I am currently coordinator of community school for Multnomah County. And up until the end of March was the principal at Wayne Middle School. I have a couple of quick things to share with you, and then with the chair's permission, would like to ask that some children and parents share with you their experience. First of all, since 1993, we've increased the number of students at Wayne Middle School by 150 children. Simultaneously, I lost 5 teaching positions, which meant that the efforts that the teachers had to put forth was increased at that particular time. So we went to staggered schedule so that we could keep our building open from 7:30 in the morning until 10 o'clock at night, occasionally on Saturdays and all the way through the summer. That was how we tried to do that, by building a collaborative process with nonprofit agencies, with the help of Bank of America, with the help of the city and the county efforts. And that was how we were able to pull together to make this kind of thing happen. But it took that kind of collective effort. My job over the next 5 years is to try to make that effort work in the rest of the school in Multnomah County. With your permission, sir, I'd like to ask the parents and children that have come from Portland to share with you some of the information about Wayne.
So I want to introduce 2 parents from Wayne Middle School who have participated in parent involvement strategies and also have their kids in after school programs, and Vicki Martell, who worked with Whitaker Middle School, another middle school in Portland, in Northeast Portland, to talk about their after school efforts. And it's just about 3 sentences, maybe, if you would, about the success of their students. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Vicki Martell, and I work in Northeast Portland, and I brought a couple students, and they're suddenly struck with shyness, but we from Whitaker Middle School, they're over there cowering. And both Rosalia and Carlos are very active in the homework club that we do, and I know you've heard a lot of good talk about after-school programs that we have, but I just wanted to emphasize, I come representing a whole room full of people that couldn't be here today because they are those working parents, mostly migrant workers, mostly farm workers, that can't come to something like this to talk. We had a budget forum in April, and 150 people came. And of the 32 people who testified, 9 students, including Rosalia, wasn't so shy that day, got up and talked about the importance of homework club, about programs to keep her out of gangs, to celebrate her heritage, and to keep her from dropping out. Also, 9 adults stood up who were parents who advocated for more retention and recreational programs. So I won't say much more other than please see me, but see 32 people behind me that stood up and testified, including their parents, about the importance of these programs.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Samantha Osborne, and I'm a parent of 4 children, all of which are in Portland Public Schools. Our family is a recent graduate of a program called FAST, and that stands for Families and Schools Together. And what it did is it brought our family together with the school. It not only empowered us as parents to be more involved in school, but it helped us to communicate with our children better. I have a middle schooler who, well, she's a middle schooler. She didn't like me. She didn't want to talk to me. She didn't want anything to do with me. After 10 weeks in this program of once a week meeting as a family, and then her and I were targeted to have one-on-one time, she talks to me all the time. She tells me things that I know she didn't tell me before, and I know that I talk to her about things that I never would have thought of talking to her about. And because of this relationship that her and I have, she enjoys the fact that I come to school unannounced and I'm suddenly in her class and talking with her teacher. I'm suddenly talking to house support and, you know, the disciplinarians at school. And at the beginning of school, she hated it. She couldn't understand why I would want to be there. because I was embarrassing her. But now she enjoys it, and she's glad that I'm there because she sees things that are happening because of the parent involvement.
Thank you.
I'm Erin Esmond, and I have two students at Lane Middle School, and they're total opposite ends of the structure. My son is a straight-A student. He's on the honor roll. He's, you know, he's involved in the after-school programs. He's involved in challenge sports, which is, it's learning to work as a team, which is really important in the workforce today. You can't be the lone ranger anymore. You have to be part of the team. My daughter, on the other hand, she's attention deficit, and she has some learning disabilities. And what the after-school programs have done for her, she feels really bad about herself because the teacher has to change the program a little bit so she can be involved because she can't work at the same level as everyone else. But she goes into the after-school program, and she's involved in the dance and the drama, and it lets her shine. She can... Everybody that knows my daughter personally, not as a statistic, loves her. Socially, she is cream of the crop. She's helpful, she's cheerful, she's cooperative. When she gets in the classroom and she gets bogged down, she hates herself. She causes problems. She's one of the 15 suspensions. She spent last week at home. The after-school program gives her such an ego boost, so much more self-esteem than she gets in other places. You know, we're atypical. My husband works. I'm at home. I'm my kid's mother. That's my job. But still, I can't give my kids the attention they need. I can't give them the total rounded education that so many of the programs that have been dropped, they need. You know, they need the art. They need the drama. It makes them a more rounded person. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who came down here today who was not part of the group that was brought down by the league yesterday?
Thank you. I'm Randy Moore. I'm the Parks Recreation Director of the City of Corrales. I'm also the chair of the STARS Collaboration, which I'll explain to you in a minute what that is. I'd like to thank you for an opportunity to testify on this bill. In the city of Corvallis, approximately 4,000 children aged 5 to 10 years of age live there. 70% of the parents of these children are in the paid workforce. And estimates place the number of school-aged care slots in our community at fewer than 700. A large percentage of the Corvallis children are going to home to empty homes in neighborhoods or to care of children slightly older than themselves. The most recent 1996 Clinton County Needs Assessment, conducted for a group of community organizations by independent research company, found that 48% of the surveyed felt that the lack of affordable before and after school care was a major or moderate problem. In 1997, the Juvenile Justice Task Force, Local Public Safety Coordinating Council, produced the Benton County Prevention Plan. The first of the 17 listed objectives is to expand positive activities for students, after-school programs, and extracurricular activities. Recent research studies highlight the fact that the peak hours for juvenile crime are between 3 p.m. and 8 p.m., and children not supervised by adults during after-school hours are at a greater risk for substance abuse, regardless of socioeconomic status, sex, race, or academic performance. A few years ago, several of us were representing public and private agencies were called to a meeting hosted by HP, one of our largest employers in Corvallis. They had surveyed their employees and found that there was a great need for after-school activities which provided a safe place for children or working parents to be and which offered a variety of programs that challenged their creative, recreational, and educational needs. HP provided us a grant of $25,000 to get started, and it took us about 4 years to effectively pull together a coalition of agencies, which is 509J School District, LBCC, City of Corvallis Park and Rec, Boys and Girls Club, United Way Library, HP themselves, Art Center, and private daycare to provide and to approve after-school programs. Our program is called STARS, Super Time for Art, Academics, Recreation, and Sports. We offer an after-school program now at 9 elementary schools in Corvallis until 6 p.m. The monthly fee is about $165 a month, which is affordable to some but not to others. We apply for grants for scholarships on a regular basis, and this past year, United Way granted us $30,000. We are currently approximately serving 300 kids and their families. We have children with special needs that need special attention, which is an added cost, and so our funds are limited. We know there are kids who go home to empty schools. We need empty houses from school, and the district has had to cut their financial support, but do provide the facilities, and we look at this program as an extension of the school program. So we truly have a collaboration and a partnership. To ensure that programs such as ours continue to help communities which need and are trying to start after-school programs, financial support is needed. I think most people agree that the more we are able to influence the behavior of youth at early age, the greater the chance they will become productive citizens in the future. And we support this bill and urge you to say yes for kids. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all to everybody who came. Mr. Adams, we have your written testimony. Former Representative Adams, former Revenue Committee member. And I want to thank everyone who came down. Thank you, kids. You could have been on the record, but you're too shy today. All right, thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3588. Now, open the public hearing on House Bill 3371. Can you tell us in a few seconds what this is? Wait till the room clears. Hey, Dizzy.
Show and tell. Is that legal?
No.
Sure it is.
For educational purposes. No.
Educational purposes.
Oh, good, true. Mercy. Okay, Dick.
Mr. Chair, what the bill does is to change one portion of the Other Tobacco Products Act. Other tobacco products include cigars, pipe tobacco, chewing tobacco, snuff, essentially all tobacco products other than cigarettes. It leaves in place the existing tax for those other products, which is 65% of wholesale price, but modifies the tax on cigars, changing it from the 65% of wholesale price to 25 cents per cigar.
Okay.
Basically it.
Thank you very much.
I included a couple of things for you. They haven't gotten lost in the shuffle here. And one is just, an example. I've used the 33% markup between the wholesale and retail price. So it just gives you an example of different retail prices for cigars and what the tax is given the current law. So, for example, if you're paying $1 per cigar, wholesale price is 75 cents, and then 65% of that is 49 cents. So you're paying about 50 cents a cigar if you're in tax if you're paying $1 for the cigar at retail. The second is, we're just trying to compare. The second sheet was done actually last session, at the end of the session. It's dated June 18th of 97.
Some of us remember that.
Yeah.
I remember the headline.
Yeah.
And that just kind of compares a tax on a wholesale price with a tax per unit and shows, it's intended to do two things. One, if you take a retail markup on cigarettes of 15%, then you can compute what that tax is as a percent of wholesale price. And in that first column, for a $2.40 retail price, you get, with a 15% markup, you get a 48% tax as a percent of wholesale price. And that's comparing then with 65%, which is currently on other tobacco products. So, the answer as to whether they're comparable or not really depends on what the retail markup is. And I don't know very well. But I suspect it's closer to 15%. The second part of that just simply shows...
We don't have a second part. We've got this.
Yeah, I don't have anything.
We have a proposed 25-cent cigar tax. retail market.
I just want to know what this has to do with that.
Okay, that was the first one. It's yeah. Just a hypothetical solution.
Yeah, I don't have
that. All right, I'll get you the second one. And again, two basic things it's trying to show that if you wanted the tax on cigarettes and cigars to be essentially comparable, 65% is probably too high. It ought to be back closer to probably the 40 or 50%. And secondly, that you're going to have a problem with a divergence in that comparison over time anyway, because a tax which is a percent of wholesale price is going to, over time, given inflation, is going to become a smaller amount for you.
Mr. Chairman,
if I can ask
Dick a quick question. Cigarette taxes, Dick, presently are placed how? Is it on
per unit?
Per unit of cigarettes. So this bill would in essence conform cigar taxes to cigarette taxes in the sense that it would be per unit instead of a percentage of the wholesale value.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Mr. McIntyre, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to be here today. My name is Don McIntyre, Gresham, Oregon, and I come to you today as a confessed Oregon tax evader. Intentionally. As much as I do love to support this state, there are times when that goes just too far. Somewhere along the line, I crossed that threshold when the latest round of tax increases on cigars was instituted. I know that members of this committee may feel that they will have difficulty with this one because of the political ramifications of actually reducing a tax on evil weed. But I think today we will demonstrate there's a clear distinction between cigarettes and cigars, and then the economics of it, and this is what we are truly bringing to you, the effects, the unintended consequences of a tax too high and what results from that. We heard some people testifying before us that if you raise the tax, you'd have the usual win-win. We will demonstrate today that having raised the tax on cigars, you have a lose-lose, and that's demonstrable. But at any rate, even if I didn't want to evade taxes, I keep getting enticed into it. The other day or a month or so ago, here is a picture, an ad in the Oregonian placed by an out-of-state company, Thompson Tobacco. And they enticed me that for a mere $15, they would send me this. And I took them up on it, made a phone call, very easy to do, and I got these nice cigars, La Gloria Cubana, Baccarat, and some other wonderful Joya de Monterey. $15. Now, that's a loss leader, but with the Oregon tax, the price on those cigars would be $63. Now, I do love my state, but I'm no fool. Let me show you. This is not a show and tell, because this one really knocked me out. These aren't just random ads in newspapers. This is business. This is one of probably about five catalogs I get every month. This is the J.R. Tobacco Company, and they're a big outfit in North Carolina. I couldn't resist it. Here are some 48 beautiful handmade cigars that in this state, those cigars alone would cost about $430 because of that tax. I paid $200 and got the box too. What I'm pointing out is that whether or not you think that cigar smoking is a glorious pastime, there are those of us that do, and it is a free country, and it's a legal product. But I probably, without revealing too much, because my wife may look at the transcript, but I do spend, considerably more than $1,000 a year on cigars. That's Oregon money going to North Carolina, New York, Miami, Tampa, wherever it is that these people sell cigars. Now, I'm here because I can always get my cigars, but I also believe in fair play for everyone in the economy. This is in the big picture of what goes on in the legislature, it's a small issue, but it's a monstrous issue for the people that are trying to make a livelihood. You think of a cigar store like Rich's, they've been in business for over 100 years, and the employees that they have. Not only will we demonstrate today that Oregon is losing revenue because of this tax, it has absolutely nothing to do with reducing cigar smoking, but it is costing people their livelihoods and their jobs. So those are my opening remarks. We have as witnesses today primarily merchants who are slowly going down the drain because of this tax. And I think we will be able to hear, too, that the state itself is losing revenue, which apparently tobacco revenue is put to good use. Well, then we're losing on that end, too. And, of course, I have with me a fellow tax evader who I thought could amplify my remarks.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chevrolet?
I just want to know if anyone read you your Miranda rights before you made your confession.
The Department of Revenue isn't.
She's taking names.
Go ahead.
Dave.
My name is Dave Rogaway. I don't own a cigar store. I own a jewelry store in Portland. You can tell by my tie that I'm an avid, you know, cigar aficionado. And I have a passion for them, and I love them. And I like to stress that I'm not addicted to them. It's been probably 2 weeks since I've had a cigar. It's not like cigarettes. When the tax was voted on, I felt after the fact that it was a smoke screen tax, that the taxpayers believed that the tax was a cigarette tax, not a cigar tax, me included. Maybe I didn't read the fine print, but that's how it was presented to the voters, that it was a cigarette tax. I'd like to stress that cigarettes are an addiction and cigars are a passion. And I know no avid cigar smokers that are addicted to cigarettes. They just have a love for a casual cigar now and then. In my retail industry, I can count the family-owned Main Street merchants on my two hands that are left. Our industry is controlled by chain stores and big box stores. The cigar shop owner is a Main Street retailer, family-owned, working on the floor, in the store, not a faceless chain being run by an out-of-state company. These people are hardworking Oregonians trying to make a buck. And with this tax, all the dollars are going out of state. I'll go into these stores and support them by buying a stick here and a stick there because I enjoy talking to these people. And I have sympathy for them as a retail merchant. I have sympathy for these people because they can't sell a box of cigars. I asked a major player that has three cigar shops in Portland, family-owned. They work in the store. I asked them how many boxes of cigars they sell. He said, we sell no boxes of cigars, none. We sell a stick here and there. And when the boxes go out the door, they go out for auctions. I donate boxes. I don't sell them. I'm getting four or five catalogs a week. The internet is a major player. One catalog I got last month had a banner on the front of the catalog that said, no Oregon tax when you order by our 800 number. All these dollars are going right out of the state. There's no expansion for these companies. They can't expand. They'd have to be out of their minds to open up more stores. Less employees. They're cutting back because they're not making the sales, and they're fighting to stay in business. And I'd like to say again, these are not chain stores. They're not big like I have. I have to fight the Zales of the world and the Ben Bridges of the world and the Friedlanders of the world, Fred Meyers of the world. These people are hands-on Oregon business owners that are disappearing due to this ridiculous tax on not a addiction, but a passion. And I'm willing to pay 25 cents per cigar to support these local merchants. It would be no problem for me, but at 65%, It's a burden. And all my dollars are going out of state.
Thank you, Mr. Rutherford.
Thank you for hearing us today. My name is Tom Whitaker. I'm a resident in Portland, and I have two retail stores, one in Portland and one in Salem. I've been in business for 21 years. I have a kind of a thing to read here that's concise and to the point, but I was immediately stirred up by some from the comments that were made about how the items were taxed and priced at retail from the revenue staff representative. The way our tax is set up in the state, we are responsible for the tax whether we pay or whether we sell the items or not. So it is a cost of goods and not a tax. So we have to have some margin in that in order to fund our inventories. So it isn't, when people say, well, you can't make a profit on taxes, it's not the same as a tax that you collect at the point of purchase. We do have to pay for that, whether we can sell the goods or not. And a lot of us have inventories that are pretty staggering with a tax on top of it. And you can't be a perfect buyer. So a lot of products you carry, you may carry for a long period of time. So it is a cost of goods. And the margins were a little soft. It sounds like the margins you were using were more of a grocery store's markup. None of us could survive with the cost of being in business today with margins that tight. That's more of a multi-million dollar grocery store in under a building. Anyway, I'd like to read this to you. The members of the House Committee, I would like to thank on behalf of many Oregon small business owners who have been impacted by the OTP taxes, particularly in the category and method of taxation on large cigars. We believe that we have a compelling argument in favor of changing the current method by which the category of large cigars are taxed in the state. We also believe and will show that both the state of Oregon and the Oregon retailers and distributors will realize more revenue through this change. We believe that by passing into law the proposed shift in method of taxation of House Bill 3371, that we can together eradicate the growing criminal element in the illegal and unreported importation and sale of cigars, increase or return the job market to its former state in our field, and increase the tax revenues at the same time. From the following statements, facts, and numbers, we believe that you will be hard-pressed to not see the merit in our request for an amended tax on cigars, and will hopefully take action on House Bill 3371. Since the onset of OTP taxes, Oregon small businesses who have depended on the sales of other tobacco products, particularly premium cigars, have suffered greatly. From the early 90s, there has been a steady decline in box sales of cigars, first because of a 35% disparity created by the initial OTP tax. By 1996, aggressive mail order houses had done considerable damage to our sales of box premium cigars. The second phase, a 65% tax that was initiated in 1997, pretty much buried us. In spite of a very strong national market for premium cigars today, box sales in Oregon are almost non-existent, down approximately 90% from the pre-tax era. These sales have gone to mail order houses, internet sales, and bootleg products. My retail business, T. Whitaker Tobacco, was established in 1978, was once a three-store operation with four salaried managers and 16 employees. Today I have two stores with two salaried managers and 10 employees, only one hourly employee on a 40-hour schedule. These operations should and would employ more people, lease or purchase more real estate, as well as pay more income taxes, property taxes, licensing fees, etc., if only we could once again have a competitive market and a more fairly levied tax system. I also own a manufacturing company called Dormier International Limited. I blend, box, and ship cigars from the Dominican Republic under various trademarks, one of which has earned some international recognition. But I have never been able to bring this product into Oregon and form a base for distribution here in Oregon because of the tax burden. In the beginning, I supported import brokerage, real estate, clerical, and warehouse jobs in the state of Florida. Today, I have found it more beneficial to appoint an importer and distributor based in Geneva, Switzerland, and operating in the U.S. through Stamford, Connecticut. I would love to have the opportunity to bring my business home. When we speak of lost sales to mail order houses, I think it would be helpful to share with you some rather staggering numbers. Publicly reported by one such mail order house, a large order out of the JR, which was mentioned earlier, posted gross sales of over $300 million in 1998. That equates to approximately 125 million cigars. The primary targets of these mail order houses are high OTP tax states. We estimate from this mail order house alone, 3 to 5 million cigars are shipped to the state of Oregon. We also know that there are individuals, organizations, and even legitimate retail operations that buy products from manufacturers, individuals, or retailers in other states, pay for these goods with cash or cashier's checks of less than IRS reportable amounts, and resell them in the state of Oregon, thus getting away with paying only part of the taxes should they be licensed, or none at all if they're unlicensed. Again, we are taxpaying Oregonians asking for a leveling of the playing field. You might ask what exactly compels so many people to buy their products from out of state, and the answer is simply one of economics. A mail order house or internet company that sells into Oregon does so not only free of tax, but generally discounts the products by another 20%. As retailers and distributors, we can overcome this 10 to 20% with service and quality of inventory and physical presence. But the current conditions make the disparity far too great. No reasonable person will pay $180 for a box of cigars that can be delivered to their doorstep for $100 plus the cost of $5 to $8 for the freight. These products from my Salem store cost $180 in Oregon. You can get these in the mail for $100 plus $5 to $8, depending on which mail order house you buy. And some of them will even pay the freight. It's pretty hard to compete with that. There's another issue, and that is one of fairness, and I would like to point out that cigarettes, though they vary in price somewhat, are taxed at a set rate with a tax stamp. So you can buy this package of Davidoff from Geneva for around $6. It has the same tax stamp on it that this, at $2, and this is a generic kind of a cigarette for $2.50, but these two are taxed the same. So when we get to the cigars, you see this cigar, which costs 63 cents at wholesale, and this cigar that costs $9.50 at wholesale is 20 times more expensive than this one. So the person that smokes this one contributes 40 cents in tax. The person that smokes this one pays $6-$7 in tax. There isn't any fairness there. And frankly, the person that buys this will buy this here because it becomes, there's no financial gain in trying to mail order for this, that by the time they pay the shipping cost, the disparity is used up in the shipping between the tax. But in something like this, it's a phenomenal amount of money that they save by buying it out of state. The damage being done to the state of Oregon by the mail order houses and other methods is strictly in the expensive premium cigar categories, where the disparity in gross sales have real significance. The simple added cost, I'm kind of repeating myself, or I'll skip that. By taxing cigars by the stick, as is done in other states, or some of the other states, uniformity is not only fair, but will bring more dollars to the OTP tax and Oregon businesses at the same time. From the facts and figures reported from the Tobacco Institute for 1997, and this is with 96% of companies reporting, 1998 figures are not in yet, 30.3 million cigars were shipped into the state of Oregon for resale. These numbers do not include mail order, scams by distributors or retail entities, individuals, or organized bootleggers. The taxes collected in Oregon for this category was reported as $8 million. If purchases remained absolutely the same, 25 cents per stick collected would equal $7,575,000, which is very close to that number. It's a decrease of $425,000. But however, we know that by this shift in taxation, and common sense tells us that reportable and taxable cigar purchases, which would be closer to 40 to 45 million cigars based upon national consumption statistics, will then be capitalized upon and bring the 97 figure of $8 million closer to $10 million or more.
Mr. Whitaker?
Yes.
I think we've got the point.
Okay.
In general. And we've got a lot of other folks to speak in.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just one word in parting. As Mr. Rogaway said, it is not a habit. It's a passion. It's something that we really enjoy. You know, others don't. But to quote Mark Twain, if there's no cigars in heaven, I don't wish to go.
Ditto. Okay, thank you. I have about, let's see, 8 other people signed up on this bill. If you have something that's new or you really need to speak or you came from out of town or something, we'd be happy to hear you, but okay, come on up. But please keep it brief, and I'm sorry if I have to rush through this. I noticed there are 3 people surnamed Paul. Are you all brothers or something? James Paul, and John Paul. Okay. Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee. Thank you for hearing us. My name is Steve Rowe, and this is my wife, Janessa Rowe. We own Cascade Cigar and Tobacco in Portland. We started business in 1992, and Thomas mentioned the issue that jobs were lost and we saw sales decrease. I did a comparison and took a look, and in 1996, I appeared on Town Hall, and I predicted we would lay people off because of this. We had, at that time, 11 employees. Some were part-time. Now we have 7 employees. I took a look at where we were at from a sales point of view, and we were a startup company. We were growing at a 3-year straight, over 75% per year. In the first year of the tobacco tax increase, our growth was only 18%. It was not the full year, and last year we were down 11%. I took a comparison and said, what if we were to actually have grown? And in that 1996 time frame, we paid approximately $39,000 in tobacco taxes. We paid $17,000 in corporate excise taxes. 1998, we paid $52,000 in tobacco taxes and only $1,800 in corporate excise taxes. The net result was there was a very minor increase in the total taxes we paid. When you look at our tobacco tax, corporate excise tax, payroll tax, and what our employees paid. I did one go scenario to take a look and said, what if we had actually continued to grow, not at 75%, but just 50%, 30%, and started kind of leveling off, and concluded that we would have paid in addition, our total tobacco tax would have been $75,000 instead of the actual $52,000 we paid if the bill had not passed. Our corporate excise tax would have grown to $26,000. Our payroll tax would have been $9,800. And our employee taxes would have grown to $12,000 because we would have hired more employees to serve our customers. Total tax loss in the 2-year period, based upon that projection, was almost $80,000 over what we paid. Clearly, this impacts us as small businesses. This is a small business issue. This is not a fair, there is a fairness issue to the cigar smoker, the small business people, and really in the premium cigar range, it is a small business market. It is not a large business market. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I'm Jan Essler Rowe. I'm the partner of Cascade Cigar and Tobacco. And we have a business decision to make, and it will be based upon this, and that is that we have 2 stores. One may not be by the end of the year. It's just that simple. I have cherry-picked my inventory, sending back overstock in excess of $8,000 this past month. We can't continue to stay in business with this kind of tax burden. It doesn't work. You're losing, we're losing. I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother, I'm not a drug dealer, I'm not any of those things. I'm a businesswoman. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Doug Berry. I am an employee at the downtown Cascade Cigar and Wine Store. I'm the wine buyer there, and I sell cigars there as well. Downtown is a little different than Southeast Portland. I deal with a lot of attorneys. I was a paralegal for 10 years. I also, for 2 sessions, have been a legislative assistant for a good senator from District 10, even though I'm a registered Republican. I'm a diverse kind of a guy.
Who would that be? I don't have my...
Avil Gordley. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. So, after 10 years, I decided I want to do something fun. So I'm working in this shop, and I continually have... I'm still working for the legislature. Keep that in mind.
According to the legislature.
The law firm I'm not working for.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
You're clarifying.
Yes. point. So I've seen, I have a very broad base of experience in this. I've worked in law firms, and I see lots of attorneys who smoke cigars, and very few of them buy cigars from me now. Almost all of them, if I see them, it's very rare, and they're buying boxes from 1-800-JR-CIGAR or www.jrcigar.com. Lou Rothman sells a lot of cigars that way. I personally, even though I get a good discount at the shop, I buy cigars from Lou Rothman. My favorite cigar, the tax on that is $4.75 for a box of cigars that I have to, you know, I got married 2 years ago. $118.75 just tax. I didn't get those from Jan. I got a different box of cigars. One hates to settle for a cigar, and it was an excellent cigar, but I got a box of cigars for Jan for $120. The same amount that I would have paid tax on the other one. I don't want to see my job downtown disappear. I've had offers from law firms at Perkins Coie. I used to work upstairs at Swabby Robinson Wyatt to come back and work for them. I really don't want to. But I guess that's my perspective, that I have these customers coming in, and even the ones that do come in, and I'll sit down in a nice leather chair and smoke a cigar and talk with me because they like me. I consider them my friends. They'll buy a cigar to try. We get a new cigar from Arturo Fuente, and they'll buy one to try it. And then they get on the phone, and they order it from North Carolina where there's no tobacco tax. And since 1997, when I was working in Salem, I've also made phone calls and asked for research from Greg Kramer at the Revenue Department. And he used to send me the figures on revenue from cigarette, well, all tobacco tax, but you have cigarette tax, and then there's other tax. And the other tax includes the cigar tax, the chewing tobacco, and the pipe tobacco. The cigarette taxes initially went up quite a bit because of the tax increase on that end. The cigar taxes, even though it went from 35% to 65%, it leveled off and started dropping. And then he sent me a projection through the year 2005, and they concluded that that trend would continue with cigars. So this, I guess I would just state again, like the others have, that it's not just the businesses that are losing here, it's the state. And if we want money, as, you know, the purpose of this tax was to raise money for the Oregon Health Plan and for education, well, the number of cigar smokers isn't going down in Oregon, but the revenue that you're getting from cigars is. And so I would urge you to review these materials in detail and see for yourself that it's not working this way, and ask that you support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. The Paul family, did you need to speak?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rasmussen.
How many more folks do we have to go?
There are five more people lined up.
I guess one more question, Mr. Chair. What time do we have to go out onto the floor?
Session is at 11.
1 hour from now. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we will not go through all of the statistics.
Just identify off the record.
James Paul. Okay. Paul's tobacco.
James Paul.
And John Paul.
Okay. Son. We won't go through all the statistics. You've had enough of those. You have a limited schedule. And basically, we would reiterate exactly what has been placed before you previously to say that we are in the process of also downsizing. And we have, over the last 2 years, have cut our workforce by about 25% to 30%.
And you believe that, as the other people testified, that the consumption is not decreasing, but people are...
Yes, sir.
Outside the state.
The last gentleman spoke very diligently about the fact that people will come in and buy a single cigar of a new line that they have been heard about or advertised. and then come back and tell us that they purchased it on by internet or some other means, and offer us one.
That really hurts. Then.
Yeah.
That hurts.
Yeah.
Okay. That pretty much sums it up. Okay. We thank you for listening to us. Thank you for coming down. Representative
Whit. I just had one real quick question, Mr. Paul.
Yes, sir.
Do you know that cigar consumption has it been increasing nationally while at the same time sales have been declining in Oregon?
We had a period when there was a demand, supply-demand problem in that the demand was greater than the supply, but once they balanced out and the cigars became readily available, what happened at that point is when we saw our sales start to tail off, because then there were other people throughout the country, or not within the state, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And yes, our consumption, as far as we know, is continuing to escalate nationwide. Particularly for a gentleman like J.R., who has something like 300 million sticks of cigars. And he you saw the advertisement, and he's out bombarding all of the states to lesser tax.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Scott Bradley and Jay Toomey. Are they still here? Okay. Very good. Thank you very much. Appreciate everybody who testified, and thank you for coming. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3371. And there were some folks here named Christensen who are here on 2495. Are they still in the audience? Okay. We'll go ahead and take you next, then, because I know you've been waiting a long time. I'll open public hearing on House Bill
My name is Judy Christensen. This is Priscilla Christensen, my granddaughter. Before I present my testimony, I'd like you to know that Priscilla is fully aware of what this bill is about, and she has agreed that she wants to participate and that it's good for her to be here on her own. And so I want to acknowledge that. She knows everything I'm going to say. Let me catch my breath in here.
Sure. By the way, just before you get started, I should add that since I did take this out of order, the staff isn't here, but this is a bill that I introduced that allows an income tax credit for certain kinds of unreimbursed assistance to disabled people living in the home. Credit's $1,500, and it passed out of the Human Resources Committee with a subsequent referral to revenue. That's why we have the bill. Go ahead.
Thank you. As I said, my name is Judy Christensen. I'm a single grandparent and sole provider for Priscilla Christensen, my granddaughter. She is age 9 and in the third grade at Whitworth Elementary School in Dallas, Oregon. I took legal custody of Priscilla when she was 2 years old. Her parents were unable and unwilling to care for her at that time. Priscilla was born with cerebral palsy. She was premature, and she experienced a brain bleed at the time of her birth. She was a drug-affected baby, and you'll see those coming up into the history. They're going to be here for you. I had a choice to turn her over to state custody or raise her myself. In my mind, there was no question as to what to do, even though at the time no one knew the extent of her disabilities. Although Priscilla and I are currently working hard to teach her independent living skills, she still requires assistance with bathing, grooming, help with toileting, physical exercise, dressing, etc. She also has ongoing medical complications produced by her condition. The latest, and there have been 3 in 7 years, surgical procedures she received was last December 17th, in which her hip socket was rebuilt and her leg was reshaped. This resulted in a very painful major procedure, which took a total of 6 days in the hospital and 8 weeks at home in a full body cast. She experienced major pain, and it set her physical gains back to be independent back 2 years. She later suffered major depression and anxiety problems. The majority portion of my time when not at work is spent caring for Priscilla and providing for her needs. For example, she had a total of 15 appointments to keep this in the month of April. I transport her and stay with her during all these appointments. They include one IEP meeting at her school, one dental appointment, one medical appointment, three psychological counseling sessions, nine physical therapy sessions, and one appointment to fit her new AFOs for leg braces. I also spent an enormous amount of time completing paperwork and forms necessary for her care and equipment. The latest was over 10 hours filling out forms and getting documentation for Social Security to prove she is still disabled. Interesting, because there is no cure for CP. Now I have to do it again for vocational rehabilitation for the state of Oregon, since Social Security turned determination over to them on eligibility, and the forms are different between the state and the federal agencies. These are not exaggerated facts. When I return from work and various appointments at night, my time is spent doing regular parent activities like dinner and homework. However, I also need to pay special attention to Priscilla's homework because of her learning difficulties and the work she missed while she was out of school with her surgery. I also do physical therapy with her and bathe her and get her ready for bed. In the morning, I get up an hour early to get her up, bed, dressed, and groomed for school. Because I am self-supporting and need to work, I spend an average of $200 per week on child care, more in the summer, less in the winter. I seldom leave her on weekends for respite care because I frankly can't afford it, and finding someone is difficult at times because of her special needs. The reason I continue to provide care for Priscilla is because she is one of the best things that have ever happened to me. She gives me back much more than she takes. She is my friend and my family, and even with all the things we have to do together, she is well worth it. By my taking Priscilla to raise as my own, I have saved the state of Oregon literally hundreds of thousands of dollars. I know many grandparents that do the same thing for disabled kids. The family caretakers in Oregon have done an immense favor for the taxpayers by using their own resources and efforts to provide care for loved ones. If all the disabled Oregon citizens now being taken care of by family members were turned over to the state for care, it would result in major expense and problems with their systems. The state of Oregon has stated many times that they support families and communities that take care of their own. We have done this, and all we are now asking is that you now show your support and your encouragement by passing this bill. This is your opportunity to make a statement about family values and to support those families that have already given up much of their own lives to care for others.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Bailey. I live in Portland. I am the parent of a child with a developmental disability, and I appear before you this morning on behalf of the Oregon Disabilities Commission, the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Council, and the 11,000 Oregon families who are members of the Community Partnerships Network. Mr. Chairman, this bill begins to address what I have always felt is a great paradox in Oregon public policy, which is that although we all believe that families are the cornerstone of our culture, that children are best cared for by their parents, that families that remain intact are the best thing that we have going in our lifetime, it is impossible for parents of children with developmental disabilities who are adults to access direct help to keep their family intact. When a family wears out, Mr. Chairman, by stress, by age, by abuse, by drug abuse, the state steps in with a financial largesse that is quite startling to me. As soon as the real family falls apart,
The state is very happy to provide foster care, adult foster care, crisis diversion, placement in group homes. That cost inevitably is thousands of dollars a month, and in some cases, Mr. Chairman, it can be tens of thousands of dollars a month. Mr. Chairman, I know that each member of this committee at one time or another has been approached by representatives of the developmental disabilities community and talked to about the wait list. Let me remind you of how it works in my life and my our lives. Children with developmental disabilities are entitled under federal law to an appropriate public education. If I could just be a little cynical for a second, what that means to many parents who have non-ambulatory, non-verbal, incontinent behavior challenge children is that those kids are gone for a few hours every day. And that enables you to do things like take a bath, have a cup of coffee, talk to another adult. But when that child reaches their 21st birthday, they enjoy no longer any entitlement to services. And so what they do is go home and are cared for 24 hours a day by an adult. These are adult children being cared for by parents. Mr. Chairman, I know of a mother in Gresham who 2 years ago her daughter turned 21. She is non-ambulatory, non-verbal, a very large young woman. And my friend Kathy had to quit her job of 18 years. She lost her home. She went on welfare. She moved back in with her mother so that she could provide 24-hour-a-day unreimbursed care for her daughter. This situation goes on in our state until the family disintegrates. This bill is not the answer to our problems. But, Mr. Chairman, a $1,500-a-year tax credit will go a long way toward buying some of the things that will enable families to continue this unpaid and largely unrecognized public service of caring for adults. I mentioned alarm systems as a potential thing to buy in my written testimony. I want you to know I'm not talking about burglar alarms. I'm talking about an alarm that will let a parent know when their runner, 30-year-old son with autism, takes off out of the house. Those things cost money. Lastly, I couldn't tell you how appropriate it is that this bill become law now. We have hammered away at this body, not this committee, but this legislative assembly for years, on the problems of the wait list. That's going to require a lot of general fund revenue. I don't think that this is going to happen this time. I don't know if it's ever going to happen. But I feel symbolically that families are ready to receive some acknowledgement, official acknowledgement, from the state of Oregon that what they do is important not only to families in our state, but it's important to the whole service provider system. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. I am, of course, delighted to respond to any questions that the chair or members may have.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Judy and Priscilla, for coming as well and for waiting for all that long period of time. I'm glad you were able to stay around. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Dolores Raymond and Sherry Riding.
Chairman Strobeck, members of the committee, good morning. I think Sherry Riding had to leave. She had another meeting to go to.
Thank you, Dolores.
She is director of the Alzheimer's chapter here in Salem. And I'm testifying on behalf of the Alzheimer's Association today and also all the family caregivers who couldn't be here. I gave to your staff person testimony from Nancy Talbot, who was not able to be here today, who cares for her sister who has multiple sclerosis, and also from Sally Madden, whose husband died about 8 months ago, who had Alzheimer's disease. Sally provided care for him, and her testimony was very moving because she talked about the exhaustion, the physical, emotional, spiritual drain on her from providing care for her husband. She also broke down the $1,500 tax credit and talked about what she could have done with that. It could pay for 150 hours per year of in-home respite companions. 82 hours per year of professional aides in the home, 72 afternoons per year of a day respite program away from home, or 37 and a half days per year of care in an all-day care facility. Those things would have meant a lot to her. I know what it's like to be a caregiver because I owned and operated an adult foster home for 6 years. I know what it's like to be on call 24 hours a day and never get enough sleep. What I didn't realize until I burned out and sold my home and began working with family caregivers is the emotional stress that family caregivers feel. The watching a loved one being just slowly fading away from Alzheimer's disease is emotionally devastating. And that realization came to me when I facilitated an Alzheimer's support group and worked with those family caregivers. All told, I've been working with caregivers and seniors for about 15 years, and I keep learning every time I meet a new family and every time I hear a new caregiver's story. Looking back at the time I spent in my foster home, my children were not happy with that activity because we pretty much lost our relationship. So when I made the decision to sell my home, my children were very happy because they got their mother back and their children had a grandmother again, and I wouldn't trade the experience for anything. I think it has made me a better and more compassionate human being, and I certainly identify with the family caregivers who have no access to respite services. I read a report that was released in February by the Alzheimer's Association and the National Alliance for Caregiving that confirms that family caregivers of people suffering from Alzheimer's disease provide care at an immense cost to their emotional, financial, and physical well-being. These things, the stresses, can sometimes result in the death of a caregiver. And I'm thinking of a particular woman whom I knew who came to my Alzheimer's support group. She was in her 70s. She was a wonderful person. She always had something to contribute to the group. Her husband had Alzheimer's disease, and she was also caring for her mother, who was over 90. This woman died, and as a result of her death, her husband was placed in an adult foster home. He went downhill very rapidly, and he died in less than a year. Her mother celebrated her 100th birthday a few months ago, and I know that was a major event, and I am very sad when I think that with better support for family caregivers, perhaps all three people might have been there to celebrate that 100th birthday instead of the mother celebrating without her daughter and her son-in-law. It's not just family caregivers who pay the cost of providing care for people with Alzheimer's disease. This disease costs American business $33.16 billion a year in hidden costs like caregiver absenteeism, loss of productivity, and so forth. Alzheimer's disease is not the only condition that provides a need for care. The costs reported to the Healthcare Financing Administration for 1997 for Medicaid and in-home care was $57,909,764 for 11,376 recipients. For institutional care, the reported cost was $59,933,921 for 13,755 people. That's a lot of money. I look around in our communities and I see an increasing and alarming shortage of caregivers. And I wonder where the caregivers are going to come from to provide all the care that's needed as our population grows. I think supporting family caregivers through this bill will be a partial answer to that question. I would remind you about the last session of the legislature when the lifespan respite bill was passed, House Bill 2013. Working with that program, a family caregiver who has the $1,500 credit could locate a qualified respite caregiver and take a break. if you've ever worked 7 days a week without a break, you know how tough it is. I know how tough your schedule is. You're in the legislature, and I wouldn't wish a 7-day-a-week schedule on any of you. I think there's growing awareness in this country of the value of family caregivers. President Clinton mentioned it in his State of the Union address. There are 17 states currently working on caregiver support legislation. Family caregivers are a wonderful resource, and I ask you to recognize their position on the front line of our community-based long-term care system and to pass this bill out of this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Dolores. Any questions? Thanks very much. Barbara Nelson is here from Alzheimer's. Well, if you don't want to, that's okay.
Okay, I do.
Okay.
Okay. President Robeck and committee members, I'm Barbara Nelson, and I have been a caregiver of a person with dementia, and I founded this Alzheimer's chapter here in Salem and Mid-Willamette, and have been still working with it for many years, so I've seen many, many, many caregivers. And just a couple of figures might help. Nationally, they've done surveys saying that 80% of folks with dementia are cared for in the home by caregivers, and many of these are 24-hour-a-day caregivers. But, you know, the loved ones want to keep them there, and they're saving taxpayers billions of dollars by keeping them out of the nursing home. Because of the length of the disease, they very often will be in there from like 2 to 10 years. So they almost always end up on Medicaid, almost. So the cost nationally is just billions of dollars. And if we can just give these in-home caregivers a little more, you know, help to help them get by with the expenses of caring for them in the home, and also, as she said, relieve their emotional strain of doing it. You got any questions?
Thank you very much, Barbara. Appreciate you coming. And of course, since I introduced the bill, I'm very supportive of this bill. But there is one more amendment that we need to get, so we're not going to be able to go into work session today. I'll ask the speaker for a variance, and we'll bring this up again next week for work session. We appreciate you coming down. Thank you all very much for your work on it.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to state for the record and for the committee members to know that I'm strongly in support of this, and I appreciate that you brought this bill. I think this is a very, very deserving group of citizens that we should be seeking some relief for, and I appreciate all of you coming and testifying on it today.
Mr. Chair.
Can I rest, Mr. Chairman?
I also am understanding of the special and intense burden that caregiving has placed on us, on these families, and it also frustrates me that we cannot do what we need to do in ways and means for these families, and hope that as we go forward in this session or in future sessions, keep in mind that there are connections between what we do in this committee and what Ways and Means is able to do in their committee.
I appreciate that, and in fact, I am a member of the Subcommittee on Human Resources in Ways and Means, and there are bills that are, in fact, the rest of care, several other things that we've been talking about recently, so I do think we're moving in that direction on that end of the spending continuum as well. Certainly, especially the in-home caregivers, extremely, as the testimony was, extremely cost-effective, and also keeps families together. I think that's very important. Thank you all. So, close the public hearing on House Bill 2495. I'm going to jump around a little more here because I do know we've got some folks who are in the building a lot and others who are not. So I'm going to open a work session on HGR 56. And Colin, if you know this is a work session, do you have a statement and something to introduce?
My name is Colin Soares from Palomas, Oregon. We have appeared before this committee before, so we won't burden you with the details of HJR 56. We're also sorry to report that we have no anecdotal testimony, so we'll go straight to the conclusion. The amendment HJR 56 places before you is not a product of politicians nor a product of power structure in Oregon. It makes no attempt to be politically pleasing nor to balance special interests. It was conceived and nurtured out of the objective motives in the exchange of ideas among concerned voters of Oregon over the past 6 years. It is designed to conform to the ideals of a good tax system set out in our earlier statement. The general election in November of 2000 is destined to present to the voters of Oregon at least one tax proposal and likely more than one. Other proposals will come from the politicians of Oregon and an attempt to please political and economic interests. It is likely to retain all the inequities of our present tax system. It is unlikely to be based on a coherent tax philosophy or a sound tax policy. The legislature should make certain that the voters of Oregon in November of 2000 have the option of voting for a tax system designed to conform to the ideals of a good tax system. We respectfully request that you vote HJR 56 out of your committee for debate and a vote in the House. Thank you for your time and hearing us and the courtesies that you've extended to us over the past few weeks.
Thank you, Colin. Paul, can you describe the Dash 1, or is this a new amendment to Dash 1?
Mr. Chair, the Dash 1 amendments do replace how the system would be introduced and how it would operate. But the basic concept is the same. It's to essentially abolish the current revenue system, state-level tax system, and replace it with the tax on gross consideration. So conceptually, it's the same. There would be a referral to voters in the year 2000. It would be effective on July 1 of 2001, and I might add, because of its referral to voters, it does have a fiscal impact.
Thank you, Paul. What I'd like to do with this, since we're getting later into the session, I'd like to get this over to the Senate. So I would like to adopt the Dash 1 and then move this to Ways and Means in order to have it funded so that it can move on to the
resolution, Ways and Means.
It has a fiscal impact, as Paul just said.
Mm-hmm. All right.
You should have the Dash 1s in a packet today, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, so the chair moves adoption of the Dash 1 amendments into HJR 56. Is there any discussion?
Yes. Dash 1,
Chair. Well, you want to replay that tape?
Okay. in a very quick way. The Dash 1 amendments are extensive, Representative Welch, but they do essentially how the system operates. They require some voter approval. It specifies four local taxing districts, authorize them to adjust rates, and describes how that will be done. And it establishes a clear areas that in which the tax would not apply, and then provides a list of that. It defines gross consideration more clearly than previously. It sets up a penalty system, a stabilization fund. So the concept is the same as the initial HGR 56. It's gone through and described its operations differently and the transition period.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Shetterly? I'm trying to recall. I know we've seen this a few times. Who's testified on this?
Mr. Soares?
I know that. Yeah. I don't I don't have a real good feel for it yet, and this is a fairly fundamental change in our state tax system.
Oh, no.
Extremely. Thank you.
Slightly. I feel like they're buying a house out of a catalog or something. I... I understand the chair's intent, but I'm not sure if this is, if we've had the discussion on this, at least to satisfy me that I understand exactly the broader consequences of this. I understand the concept. As we know, Measure 47 was a fairly straightforward concept, but it had consequences that tied us up in knots for a session. I'm not real comfortable moving this forward with the prospect of something like that again.
Mr. Chair, I've got to remind President Shadow that you and I are term limited.
Yeah, thanks. I might be self-term limited.
As I said, Representative, my intent is to get it to Ways and Means so that it can then move along and have a more full discussion when it gets to the other chamber. Simply because we're running out of time over here.
Mr. Chairman, would you like us to refer it out without a recommendation to Ways and Means? Is that what you're requesting?
Right.
Oh.
So just to refer it to Ways and Means.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen?
You know, sometimes I make votes on concepts I'm not real comfortable with because it should move forward, and sometimes the issue is so huge that I cannot even make that vote because I just, it's not. This is an overwhelmingly huge piece. I guess I need to tell you I will not be supporting the motion to move it to Ways and Means.
Okay. Well, we've had a lot of people who have said we need to give Oregonians an alternative and take a look at it. And so that's why I think
Mr. Chairman?
Move forward, yes.
I'm certainly willing to support moving this to Ways and Means and giving this an opportunity to have more discussion on this issue. And I think it's probably not going to make it out to the ballot this session, but I think it's certainly appropriate that we consider different alternative tax schemes. I think there is a growing recognition that Oregon's tax system today is flawed, and we need to look at alternatives to our tax system, and I'm certainly willing to accommodate your wish to move this away from me.
Okay, thanks. The motion before us is to adopt the dash one. Is there any objection?
No, I'm not objecting.
Okay. Dash 1 is adopted. And the chair moves HJR 56 without recommendation to the Ways and Means Committee. Any more discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, this is a very profound change, and the amendment was just passed out this morning. I would request that we bring this back early next week so that the members can have a chance to read what has been just handed out. I think it's an interesting to generate a discussion, but I think I would like a chance to read over the measure and get some sense of what it involves before sending it forward on our part as a revenue committee. This is certainly a fundamental issue for us to consider. And I think there's a good chance I might be comfortable after reading it, forwarding that discussion to the Ways and Means Committee. But I would like a chance to read the measure and consider it.
Any other comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shadow.
I guess, again, the game plan goes to Ways and Means. Where does it go from Ways and Means?
Well, then it goes to the Senate, I assume, doesn't it?
Without the floor.
Where does it go to the floor first?
No, it has to go through the floor.
It's the House. Sooner or later, it has to show up on the House floor. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. There's 1, 2, 3. Looks like we might have a constitutional problem. If we were to vote on this measure, who would be voting in favor of it? 1, 2, 3, 4. I think we're going to have to bring this back again. Well, sir, we're in work session. We have a motion before us.
I'll give you about 1 minute then.
My name is Bill Thomas from Eugene, and I'm wondering, and I fought for 40 years, 20 years for property tax relief. Are all of you people aware that about 4 or 5 years ago, people here in Salem passed a bill so that nobody in the state of Oregon would pay more than 9% of their income in state income taxes? Are all of you aware of that? And I'm for it. But are you aware that we've got thousands of disabled people, blind people, veterans, low-income people, that are not paying 9%, but 15 and 20 and as high as 35% of their total income in property taxes? Are you people aware of that? We moved here a while back. We lived in the house for 28 years, and I found some of my old records. And I paid, in 28 years, I paid 5 times as much in property taxes as I paid for the house. And I don't know about you people, but it just makes me cry when I see people that are being forced out of their homes. You people have a tremendous responsibility this year, probably more than any time in our history. But if you want to help the low-income people, not just low-income people, but our children, I have a son that makes a damn good income, but his wife stays home to take care of their 2 disabled kids. And he's got a home. You're going to help these people down the road. They talk about affordable housing. A few years, only the rich are going to be able to afford housing. So I hope that you people will really vote to pass this, to eliminate property taxes, which is the most sinful, regressive tax there is. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for coming up. We're going to have to bring this bill back, give the members some time to digest the dash ones, and so have this back on the agenda.
Mr. Chair.
Work session HGR 56 and open public hearing on House Bill 3345. Lynn McNamara, Mayor Faber, and David Olson.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Members of the committee, Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities, and on behalf of the League, I just want to thank the committee for its latitude this morning. The League is in opposition to both the original bill and the Dash 1 amendments of House Bill 3345. With me is Mayor Gordon Faber of Hillsborough, who will go into more detail about our concerns, and David Olson, who is the manager of cable and franchise for the City of Portland, who can answer your questions since I'm pinch-hitting as the franchise person today. We recognize that this is a continually changing environment, not only for the telecommunications industry, but for all users and rentpayers for public rights of way. And as such, we wouldn't be opposed to a study per se, but what this bill calls for is a study with a predetermined outcome and one that places a moratorium on revenues for the public rights of way revenue in the meantime. Just contrast that with the environmental tax study bill that you passed earlier this week, which has a broad-based participation, looks at a lot of possibilities, has criteria for evaluation, and does not stop the revenue stream in the meantime. So we would, again, oppose this bill, and I'll ask Mayor Faber to discuss it more detail. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor?
Chair Strobeck, members of the committee, my name is Gordon Faber, and I'm the mayor of Hillsborough, and I'm here to testify in opposition to House Bill 3345. The League of Oregon Cities opposes the original bill and the Dash 1 amendment. Since House Bill 3345 was filed, proponents of this legislation have assured us it was merely a placeholder and that subsequent amendments are actually the substance of the bill. Therefore, the following points only address the Dash 1 amendments. First of all, Section 1 of the amendments creates a 2-year preemption of city authority under state statute and city charters. Number 1, cities shall not impose any new fees, charges, or taxes to any telecommunications provider. This is ORS 221.510 or 221.515. Cities shall not increase permit fees. Permit fees are cost recovery and driven by telecommunications providers, even if the costs increase. This could seriously hamper our ability to manage the rights of way. Section 1 could prevent cities from renewing existing telecommunications providers' franchises for continued use of the public rights of way. Section 1 creates preferential treatment for telecommunications providers over all others for use of the public rights of way. Permit fees may be charged to cover the administrative costs of a city to coordinate use of this public property. This bill would create a special exemption for telecommunications providers. Section 1 may violate Section 253 of the Federal 1996 Telecommunications Act. Section 253 of the Telecommunications Act provides that local governments may receive compensation from telecommunication providers for the use of the rights of way on a competitively neutral and non-discriminatory basis. Section 1 of this bill would result in unequal treatment of telecommunication providers by distinguishing between new providers and existing providers. While Section 2 of the amendments attempts to correct some of the problems in Section 1, Section 2 may also violate Section 253 of the Telecommunications Act by treating new providers differently than other providers. Finally, we oppose the creation of a so-called task force as outlined in House Bill 3345. The results of the task force study are predetermined by the Dash 1 amendments. The task force is directed to reach a specific conclusion, a uniform statewide law. One state law regarding the use of rights of way, payments of fees, and other forms of compensation is not good public policy. What may be appropriate management in Pendleton would not necessarily work in Portland. The creation of a task force is not timely. A study would be appropriate at such time when there is actual competition in the telecommunications industry in Oregon. I urge you to vote against this legislation today, and I thank you for your time.
Mr. Mayor? Mr. Oakley?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm here to respond to any questions you may have and otherwise support the mayor's testimony and the League of Cities testimony.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Franchise fees are obviously a very key part of city budgets. Do you not agree?
That's why we're here, Mr. Chair. Trust me.
Do you have some sort of a statewide average of what percentage of income is based on franchise fees?
Mr. Chair, not a percentage of income, but franchise fees tend to be the second largest revenue source for cities.
What's the first largest? The local property tax?
I believe it's property.
Mm-hmm. Most assuredly, but it would be devastating, and particularly in this age when we have no alternative. We are very limited in where to go for other funds, and this would be in the post-Battle Measure 5, 4750 era, is the worst of all possible times for us to have to go searching for revenue to replace this revenue.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for waiting around, Gordon.
It was my pleasure, Ken. Thank you.
Jenny Lang, Dave Fiskum, and Mike Dewey.
Chair, good morning. Dave Fiskum, representing Electric Lightway, the Oregon Telecommunications Company. Listening to my left are people you already know. I'm pleased to appear with them today, Jenny Lang from U.S. West and Mike Dewey from the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association, to support the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3345. For reasons of time and your busy schedule, Mr. Chair, we'll be brief this morning, but let me indicate that we appear here on behalf of a far larger coalition of a variety of interests, and I'll just mention them to you.
In total, U.S. West, Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association, ELI, MCI, DFT, GTE, AT&T, Sprint, Oregon Telecommunications Association, AirTouch, and Nextel. I'll turn to Jenny to describe the Dash 1 amendments in some more detail, but let me say that policies on franchise taxes, fees, and assessments on users of municipal rights of way are a very important issue, both for you and for companies like ELI. ELI, as some of you know, is a homegrown Oregon company. We began business in Oregon about 10 years ago with 3 employees, and today we have around 1,200 employees and are active in a number of states, including attempting to compete in Oregon. In Oregon today, we deal with about 25 municipalities regarding franchise fees, and that number is growing every day. The complexity of that business, the cost of that business, and the uncertainty of the fees that will be charged in that business is a very important issue for us, and that serves to underline why we're here suggesting to you that this issue, the cost of issuing franchise fees, the size of those fees, the time it takes to issue those franchises is a subject worthy of your consideration. We believe you should, in fact, be prompted to set up a task force of the sort described in House Bill 3345 so that all participants can study this issue. And while that study is underway, we have, in fact, advocated in the Dash 1 amendments a moratorium on new taxes, fees, and assessments, and I will leave to others the chore of describing that in more detail. Let me add that we do not want to predict the outcome of that study, and if words need to be changed in the Dash 1 amendments to illustrate that point, so be it. And we have tried to convey informally that perception to others, but that is true as we appear before you today. With that, Mr. Chair, and with your indulgence, I'll turn to Jenny and then to Mike.
Okay. Actually, Dave, I did have a question. Is the Dash 1 amendment supposed to be 3 pages long?
Oh, that's the problem.
I've been trying to follow this.
Yeah,
it goes to A, B, C, sub 3, and then all of a sudden jumps to E, F, and then there's no section 3. And
first here,
Dash
1 amendments are, in fact, 3 pages long, and my copy, they're each numbered. So you, at the bottom right-hand corner.
Yeah, we go from page 1 to page 3, and that'll do it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, here's the other side.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jenny Lang. I represent U.S. West. This proposal places a 2-year moratorium on the imposition of new taxes, fees, and assessments on users of municipal rights-of-way and calls for a task force comprised of both industry and government representatives to examine the issue of right-of-way compensation. The task force is directed to make findings to the next legislative assembly. The proposed legislation was drafted out of a perceived need for a timeout in the conflict that has developed between cities and users of the rights of way. Since the passage of the 1996 Federal Telecommunications Act, there's been a flurry of activity in this area, and U.S. West alone has been involved in trying to negotiate a number of proposed changes to existing agreements, some of which have been enacted by cities and are now in court. In addition, we've been trying to work with the Metropolitan Area Communications Commission, which has been in the process of drafting a model right-of-way ordinance based on certain assumptions that not all of the users necessarily share. Depending on the classification of company, users of the right-of-way compensate cities based on a number of different criteria. For example, cable companies pay 5% of all gross revenue, and Mr. Dewey will talk a little more about that. Facilities-based telephone companies like U.S. West or Electric Lightway pay up to 7% of their local exchange access. Long-distance companies' compensation is based on the linear feet of right-of-way that they use. Resellers of communication services don't pay anything on the margin between the wholesale price and the retail price. Wireless and satellite providers don't pay at all. However, with the convergence of the telecommunications industry, all of these companies are already competing against each other or will be with the same types of products. The business of providing telecommunication services is changing rapidly, as we all know, and the old laws may not be appropriate for this business any longer. this legislation provides an opportunity for all of us to establish ourselves as a leader and a state that will try to foresee some of the changes in the business and get ahead of them. It allows an opportunity for a joint examination and common understanding of the compensation issues by both the government players and the industry participants. It would not upset current law during the examination period. Section 1, subsection 4 allows cities desiring to increase their privilege tax on the telecommunications companies within their boundaries of the existing law to do so. What it attempts to prevent is the introduction of new fees, taxes, or other compensation that may end up having to be resolved in an adversarial arena. We would prefer to try to resolve these issues in a cooperative effort between all of the participants. The legislation does not presuppose any particular outcome. As Mr. Fiskum noted, if there are words that need to be changed that would make that clearer, we would be happy to talk that through. It suggests that certain items should be examined. This type of study can't be done on a city-by-city basis, but should be done in a broader context so that a statewide policy could be established. That's what we're proposing. I urge you to support this legislation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Are you seeing cities add on more franchisees to already existing companies? Is that what the prompted this?
Mr. Chairman, they may not, in the case of a telecommunications utility, they are limited to 7% of exchange access, gross revenues that are defined as exchange access. What we do see that happening is additional permit fees or fees being levied by other departments. For example, the city, in the city of Portland, we worked through a situation where the city wanted us to pay fees if our facilities crossed any park property. So in addition to the franchise fee, it was a fee on crossing park property. And the other thing that we're seeing is additional requirements around either a regulatory situation or the operations of our business within city boundaries.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Continue looking at the toward the end of your comments, maybe the lawyer in me always picked up on these things, but your reference to having to resolve this in an adversarial arena, I think you don't mean the legislature.
That would be true.
Yeah. This is one of these fix it or we'll sue kind of things. Is that, Mr. Chair, but I guess the risk, though, is the state, is the city's risk, right? I mean, and not the state. You would, any litigation in this adversarial arena would be against the city.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, that is the case. So to speak.
Mr. Dewey.
Thank you, Your Honor. For the record, Mike Dewey with the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. I understand you have a next schedule still. I will be as brief as I possibly can. We agree with Mr. Fiskum and Ms. Lang regarding this is a timeout, and if we need to develop some language, if the opponents to the bill believe that there would be a predetermined outcome regarding the study, and that really is all it is a study, we are happy to work with the opponents with regard to that language. We are seeing telecommunications ordinances, new ordinances, the City of Eugene, City of Ashland, and some others have enacted such ordinances. And these are in part revenue raising. And that is why we have come to you to start talking about, let's see if we can get some sort of, in my mind, sense in terms of the process, determine the best way to make charges. And I think cable is a pretty good example. This legislature cannot do anything about it because of a federal act. Cities have the authority to impose a 5% franchise fee, and we're not impacting that at all in this legislation, nor would we intend to. The City of Portland has an additional 3.64% on that, and you might wonder about the 6.4%. That's a tax on a tax that gets you the 0.64. So now you're at 8.64%, so it's higher than the telephone company, That's fine. Through negotiations, they agreed to do that in the franchise, but quite frankly, with our competition, every time we start to see these increases and others aren't paying it, albeit they aren't using the rights of way, and we believe we are paying our sufficient share of the rights of way and not pay any more, that we have to at some point in time say enough is enough. Now, we could have come to you with a bill on basically some prohibitions. We chose not to do that. Other states have done that. We thought the best way to do this is work through a process to see if we can figure out what some of these costs are so that we all have an indication of what those fees are. Again, we're not going to limit what they can do today because we have not preempted that. Last but not least, we're not talking about the Boxing and Wrestling Commission this session, unfortunately, because of somebody in the middle office. But nonetheless, that is a 6% tax on some events. So when you take the Eugene ordinance of 2%, you've got 6%, and then the 8.64% in Portland, if I do my math, that's 18.64% on an event, a gross revenue, if you will. That seems to be fairly significant to us, and that's why we would like to have this bill move forward. We would agree to work with those that don't like it to see if we can work on some language.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3345. And I want to let you know that we're going to do 3610 and 3611, and I apologize to the others of you who came for other bills. We'll have to see if we can get those back on the schedule, but we are going to be out of time. We have to be on the floor at 11. So I apologize for you people who travel from out of town. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bills 3610 and 3611. Mm-hmm. Mr. Bowman.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm Joanne Bowman, state representative representing District 19 in Northeast Portland. First, I want to really thank the chair of this committee for scheduling these bills. These have been my nightmare bills this session. Ones that I thought were put in, and I was told they weren't, and then I got them back, and they weren't what I asked for. But today, we actually have bills that reflect what my request was way back before the session started. House Bill 3610 is a simple bill. What the bill seeks to do is to eliminate many outdated, outmoded, and no reason for their continuing existence of tax credits that currently exist. And I understand that this committee has actually voted out some bills already that address some of the issues that are in this bill. And I appreciate the committee making that action a little earlier in this session. But today I'm here to talk about the pieces that this committee did not address in the legislation that they moved forward. It is my understanding that the pollution control tax credit was not included in your piece of legislation that went to the floor. And I am here to encourage you to make that definitely a piece that would be repealed this session. And we are talking a minimum revenue impact this session, but I think it sends the message that we are going to start holding people accountable for the tax breaks that we give them. If, in fact, people are doing things that are above and beyond and it's good for the state and we make the conscious decision that those are, in fact, the appropriate things to do, then that would be positive. But to continue a tax credit because we've always done it and state law and federal law has superseded what the tax credit was intended to do, in my opinion, is not responsible of us. There are a couple of other pieces that I'd like to bring out, and then I have people that will talk about very specifics of 3610 as well as 3611. Let me also say for the record that 3611 is a way to revise our current tax structure by reducing the personal income tax rate and increasing corporate income tax and exercise tax rate. But the goal of 3611 is to do an equalization formula so that very small businesses and individuals are and other businesses are paying the exact same level of taxes. Mr. Chair, I don't know whether you have received the revenue impact statements from 3610 and 3611, but I did bring extra copies in case you had not.
We do.
You do have them? Excellent. And before I turn it over to my expert testimony, I also want to make available for the committee an article that's dated December 7th, 1998, that talks about where all the big spending in the state budget is, and it's clearly in the tax breaks that this body continues to provide. And so with that, I will turn it over to the other.
Thank you, Representative Bowman. Chair Strobeck, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Berg-Rempel. I work for SEIU, and that represents 28,000 public and private sector workers in Oregon. Tim Nesbitt is normally the person from SEIU who speaks to you on tax issues, and I know you've heard quite a bit from him this session, and I'm just going to reiterate some points that relate to these bills. We strongly support, of course, both House Bill 3610 and 3611. 3611 would equalize corporate and household tax rates at 5, 6, and 8.85%. Since the corporate starts at 6.6% and the household is at 5, 7, and 9%, this is an increase in the corporate tax rate and a slight decrease in the rate for households and individuals. And as you're aware, there's been changes in our tax structure over the last several years. And personal income taxpayers have borne a greater share of the tax burden, while businesses have actually borne less and less of the tax burden. This bill reduces the rate for individual taxpayers and, you should note, 85% of Oregon businesses. What that means is that 85% of Oregon businesses are either S-Corp, sole proprietorships, or limited partnerships, and pay taxes at the 9% rate. C corporations pay at the 6.6% rate, and what that creates is a significant advantage for larger businesses in Oregon over the smaller sole proprietorships and small businesses. This, of course, would equalize that. I'd also like to remind you that business pays on profit after they've deducted the cost of doing business. Individuals pay on gross income. So what that means is, while a business can deduct the cost of their place of business, a family is not able to deduct the cost of rent. And so even if these tax rates are equalized, there's still a certain inequality in the fact that individuals pay on gross income and businesses pay profit alone. Well, there's also a couple of other facts I'd like to remind you of. There's been some studies of Oregon's tax system, and they have demonstrated that Oregon's business tax share is relatively low compared to other states. We actually rank 43rd out of 50 states in the District of Columbia in our business tax share. Our household tax share is high. We rank 5th out of 51. What that means is that we are pulling the greater share of our taxes out of households as opposed to business. Oregon's overall tax burden as a percentage of personal income, however, is relatively low. Slightly higher than average for households, 22nd. Compared to neighboring states, which we often compete with in business, that's Washington, Idaho, Nevada, and California, Oregon imposes the highest tax share on households and the lowest tax share on businesses. So Oregon really has chosen a tax structure in which households bear a higher percentage of the initial tax burden than citizens in most states. And as a result, we see less in state and local public services for each dollar in tax that they pay than most Americans do. I think what happens is that households start to feel squeezed and feel like they're really taxed and almost overtaxed. And because businesses are paying less and less, our schools get less and less money. So we end up in a situation where schools feel squeezed, households feel squeezed, and businesses are doing pretty well. Oh, we're almost out of time. I'm going to make one comment about 3610.
Thank you.
And that is the pleasure boat exemption, which costs Oregon taxpayers $40 million. So instead of giving a tax break to pleasure boat owners, we could actually educate 4,000 K-12 students for a year, provide the Oregon Health Plan to 22,000 children, or house 800 prisoners. I think we should weigh those versus the benefit of giving a tax break to pleasure boats. Thanks.
2 minutes is what it looks like. I'll be brief.
Yeah, just let me interrupt for just a moment because we do need to, before members leave, by the way, I just did call and you're all well excused for the beginning of session. But I need a quorum in order to move a bill to Ways and Means, so I'd like you all to stay here for that.
And, Mr. Chair, I support the movement of that bill.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second.
What are we talking about?
3440, that's the last one we'll deal with.
That's the good pension.
And the other thing is this issue on boats, since you mentioned, I don't mean to interrupt your testimony, but I did speak to Representative Bowman about this the other day, about a number of these provisions of 3610. The cigarette samples, Representative Rasmussen carried that on the floor the other day. We already did that. Pollution control credit, we examined that and decided to leave the sunset in place since there are businesses that are in progress and making changes and doing things based on that existence of that tax credit. It does sunset in 2 more years anyway. And as far as the property tax exemption for pleasure boats and summer homes, that looks like low-hanging fruit. You know, it looks like real easy picking. But in fact, the property tax exemption for pleasure boats is in lieu of the money that boat owners pay to the Marine Board. So it's a direct offset. We're not talking about giving somebody a tax break for buying a yacht or for putting a summer home on land. They pay the Forest Service or they pay the Marine Board, and instead of double taxing, we're just saying we only pay once. And it shows up, looks like, it has a very different appearance than what it really is.
Yeah, I looked in the tax expenditure report on that. I just got to respond to that. And that those fees bring in $5 million, and the tax expenditure costs $45 million, the difference between those being $40 million that we're still not getting. That's my read of the tax expenditure report.
The tax expenditure? You mean $45 million?
Yeah, that's on page 221. It discusses the fees that are paid and those fees generate $5 million. And it should generate...
That exemption is an extension of the personal property or personal use exemption, much as the same as motor vehicles are exempt.
Right.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Anyway, it's been there since 1959. It was part of the original establishment of the Marine Board. So there's a perception issue.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your comments, and I do know that some of these issues have been addressed, and you may have been out of the room when I was graciously appreciating you for having moved those bills out.
I was here.
Oh, you were there.
I have not even left the room. I only went over to the telephone for to excuse the committee.
Well, Mr. Chair, I do want to talk about one piece that we have not talked about, and that is the property tax exemption for second homes. And I believe that this is something that this committee should take real consideration of. I can understand the exemptions on the property that you live in, but I don't understand us providing property tax exemptions for people who are fortunate enough to be able to have a second home somewhere else. And so,
talking about the summer homes, which is, if I'm not mistaken, I don't mean to get into a debate about this one, but it's on federal land, and the owners pay the what would be property tax amount and the lease of land to the federal government, but because it's federal land, the property tax is exempt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for pointing that out. That is one separate issue, but the second issue is still, in fact, the property tax exemptions on second homes, it's not specific to on federal lands, was my reading of that particular exemption. So. I'm sorry, we do have one other person.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt.
And I promise I will keep it short.
Okay.
My name is Catherine Pfeiffer. I'm the Money and Politics Organizer with Oregon Action. Statewide, Oregon Action has over 23,000 dues-paying members with members in every county in our state. The membership of Oregon Action is made up of ordinary people who play by the rules but are frustrated by the fact that they are working longer hours for less pay and are not achieving economic security. Our work with the recently released job gap study shows that one of the reasons people are not achieving economic security is tied in not only with the lack of living wage jobs, but also because of the current lopsided tax structure in our state. Oregonians are paying more in taxes than ever before, and they're frustrated by the continuous cutbacks in social services such as education, health care, transportation, and other livability issues. What is happening is that we're seeing that it's forcing many working Oregonians to have to turn to public assistance. The equalization of the corporate income tax would make for a more level playing field for ordinary Oregonians. As was said earlier by previous testimony by Jeannie Berg-Rimple, corporations pay only 6.6% tax on their profits after they take deductions on the cost of doing business. Individuals, on the other hand, pay 9% total income tax. The proposal of bringing down the income tax rate for the average Oregonian by less than 0.25% and increasing the rate for corporations by 2.25% would bring in an additional $155 million in the next biennium. As the debate rages in this state on funding issues around issues such as education, health care, and transportation, and other livability issues, Oregon Action's position is that other than the students themselves, business has the most to benefit from a well-educated workforce. Education is a sound investment for business. Business leaders should and have been in the forefront of demanding higher standards from Oregon students, and therefore, they should be willing to make the investment to achieve those standards. We wholeheartedly endorse House Bill 3611 to help bring back into line a more fair and just tax system. And also, because I know that you're all running a little bit short of time, on the backside of the written testimony, I included where we received the research. And if you do wish to get a copy of the job gap study where much of this information was derived from, it's on www.oregonaction.org. And just click on the job gap study and go right to the Oregon section. Either that or else give us a call. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make one very quick final comment. And what I'd like to say is I hope that this committee gives House Bill 3611 very serious consideration. From the testimony you've heard, that when we talk about the difference between personal and corporate tax, we're really talking about personal and small businesses and corporate tax. And because, as you know, in Oregon, 85% of businesses are, in fact, very small businesses that pay the exact same rate as individuals pay in taxes. And so we're truly talking about an equalization that will benefit small businesses, individuals, and it would share the tax burden equally among all of us who have an opportunity to participate in the state of Oregon. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your listening to these two bills. We'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions?
Huh? Nope. We just wowed you, so you just
yeah.
All right.
You can vote.
All right.
Have a good day. Thank
you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3610 and 3611 and open are we up for a work session?
3440.
Open a work session on House Bill 3440.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3440 to Ways and Means with no recommendation.
Representative Rasmussen moves House Bill 3440 to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation. Any discussion? Do you want to tell us what this is? Why?
Very briefly, this is a bill that deals with some of the pension issues in the PERS system and the burden on the city and counties. And they're in a place where they need some a chance to review and manage how that is being dealt with. And by moving this bill forward, we're continuing to keep alive an option so that everyone has an opportunity to come to a resolution.
Mr. Chairman, have we had a public hearing on this bill?
I don't recall.
We didn't. You did the work session.
No, he's asking if we had
one. I'm asking if we had a
public hearing.
No, we have not had a public hearing.
No, we have not. Mr. Chair, makes it pretty hard to vote on it. We haven't had a public hearing on it. I frankly haven't had sufficient testimony to know what the bill even does.
Okay. The motion is to move the, I think I said this already, move House Bill 3440 to Ways and Means without recommendations. Any more discussion? Any objection?
I object.
Representative Wood, object. House Bill 3440 moves to Ways and Means Committee without recommendation. Close the work session, House Bill 3440, and I want to thank you all very much for hanging in today, and please adjourn.
Are they waiting for me?
No, I'm moving.